Valediction, a novella by Jacob Strunk. Read by Molly Mayville. Part 1. Goodbye. One. It was October when they found her, 3 weeks before Halloween. First frost had cleared the mire between earth and heaven, left by the humidity of late August. The crisp air breathed new life into the valley, and the townsfolk flitted about with renewed enthusiasm, finally setting out to prepare for summer's parting. The cold had come late this year, an Indian summer burning clear through September. Folding chairs and baseball mitts, usually stowed just past Labor Day, lie in front lawns, decorative reminders to make more lemonade or pick up another case of beer on the way home from work. Most of the birds had stayed past their perennial time of retreat, and their enthusiastic vocalizations echoed unhindered through a clear, empty sky. They would join the others soon enough in more practical and hospitable locations, but for now they glided on refreshing currents to which only they were privy. School had been in session for over a month, but its coming this year had not brought with it the usual sense of longing or regret. Mid-afternoon, the doors would swing open, spilling children into the local playgrounds and onto the streets, the whining of pedals and pattering of ked-covered feet filling their elders' ears. Rows of parked cars lined Main Street for long lunch hours or early evenings. People rushed home to barbecues and ball games. Businessmen changed out of their ties and into t-shirts to wash cars and clean gutters. Across town, rakes swept across lawns in unison as black garbage bags were carried, stuffed to the street. Those leaves left unbagged soon became trampolines and projectiles, the once neat piles spreading across yards, across property lines, across streets, acres upon acres until the town sat blanketed in vibrant red. The Route 26 bridge, in the center of town, looked down on canoes and fishermen. Children, still fat from roasted marshmallows and cotton candy at the fair, waded in the stream below, still fat from unusually heavy summer rain, while the water coursed past them, subtly down and through, emptying into the lake. Across New England, neighboring towns with equally regal and decidedly simple names, Rumford, Bethel, Turner, North Waterford, delighted as well in the fervor of fall's arrival. In the valley, a deep blue dome rose high over the swelling red trees. Steeples poked out and pointed skyward, bright beacons of white in the splendor of receding chlorophyll. And so it was that they found her, the morning after first frost, beneath a clear blue sky on a blanket of dead, dry leaves. Her earthen bed reflected the calm surrender in her open eyes. Red and brown, the ground peacefully held her in its gentle grasp. To say her absence was unnoticed would be untruthful. In fact, many in town noted that day a difference without her presence. They joked of foul play and weather, kidnappings and alien abduction. They laughed and sipped their coffee, but none thought twice of her whereabouts. Most were too wrapped up in their own unrepentant joy to give it much thought. It was Corey Wentland who found her, chasing Roger, the black lab, through the forest behind Town Hall. Corey had taken the freedom of fall particularly literally, granting himself a leave of absence from school. More specifically, he had embraced any excuse to miss a chemistry final in Mr. Garrison's class. Days go by, he had thought to himself in innocent mockery of the local proverb, a saying passed down through the indigenous people of the valley. To be fair, Roger found her. By the time Corey ascended the hill, Roger was curiously probing the area, his graying muzzle ruffling her clothing. Distracted by the view, the steeples poking inquisitively out of the canopy below him, Corey at first didn't notice Roger's discovery. A helpless whimper behind him finally spun him to face what lay on the forest floor. Her eyes were open, and it was all he could do to look away from them, his jaw hanging agape. He stood and stared, utterly motionless, even when Roger licked his hand comfortingly. Half an hour later, he would burst out of the forest, Roger close behind him, and proceed directly to the squad car parked in front of Fran's diner. But for now, he was transfixed by his first taste of mortality. They wouldn't find the note until later that night, placed neatly on the kitchen table and held down with her chicken and rooster salt and pepper shakers. It was written in her clean, legible hand, one so many of the townspeople were accustomed to reading. Its message was clear and concise. She had never been one for indulgence. I can't anymore. Once, maybe. With love, C. The empty bottle of prescription sleeping pills sat next to it, neatly capped, the label facing outward. A topic of conversation the next day would be her ability to make it to the top of the hill with all those pills in her belly. People would be amazed at her resilience, saying things like, "She must really have wanted to do it," and, "She shouldn't have made it out of her house, let alone up that hill." Then again, they'd add, "She was eating for two." They would speak nonchalantly, but stumble occasionally. They would tiptoe around words, less out of respect for the dead than superstitious karmic belief. She was not pregnant. She was eating for two. Not suicide, but it. Days go by, they would mumble, bringing the subject to a close, at least for the moment. Days go by. Time heals all wounds. Keep moving. Don't look back. Their mantra was amalgamation. It was a cure-all, and they peddled it to one another as if it were magic elixir, a tonic to close painful gashes in their hearts and, if need be, to close their hearts completely. But the town as a whole did not reel from the tragedy, as one may expect. Rather, it faltered ever so slightly before regaining its step. They had seen misfortune before and would see it again. Keep moving. Don't look back. Time does indeed heal all wounds. Days go by. 2. Ellen Williams couldn't leave her car. Her right hand floated above the ignition, attached to strings, independent of her resolve. She squeezed her eyes shut, trying to will her hand to slowly descend, grasp the key and turn it, killing the engine. Her left hand sat cemented to the top of the steering wheel, her knuckles white with strain. She focused every muscle on turning the key. She had to. It was something she'd been doing since 16. It was the first step in a simple procedure which ended in exiting the car. Getting out of the goddamn car. She gasped, realizing for the first time she had been holding her breath. With this, her eyes snapped open and she looked quickly to the ignition. A weak, nervous laugh escaped her, and she turned the key, pulled it out of the slot, and set both hands in her lap. They nestled and slept deservedly. She looked down. She had left the town almost 10 years earlier, young and full of ideas, full of hopes and dreams, full of piss and vinegar, some would say. It was summer then, and she imagined it was some kind of irony that her first return would be in autumn. She hated the fall. Always had. It was oppressive, a veil which descended over the green pleasantries of summer with no remorse. It choked out the freedom that warm weather promised, suffocated it with nothing but the assurance of a cold, dead winter as consolation. Beyond that, it got damn uncomfortable, damn quickly. Shorts and t-shirts soon replaced by thick parkas and bulky rubber boots. She had left and never looked back. She had promised she would never look back. But here she was, in her rusted silver Nova on Route 26, which doubled as Main Street, looking down at her hands and wishing she had come back sooner. She left Los Angeles as soon as the call came, which she presumed was shortly after the discovery of Cassie's body. Her father dealt with his loss by putting himself to work. There were things to be done, after all, phone calls to make. Arrangements to set straight. Ellen had driven straight through in a near-record 40 hours, stopping only for gasoline and cigarettes. She could have pulled over. She should have pulled over. Her father was pushing the arrangements back a few days to give her time, but she couldn't have slept if she wanted to. She was fueled by the unexpected grief that sat in her stomach like a thick, dull rock. She was fueled by guilt and longing and regret. The phone call itself had been short and sweet, the way she always hoped these things would be. There was no real crying, and there was no real consolation. She had answered on the third ring. Hello? Ellen. She recognized her father's voice immediately, despite the years. Despite the time and the anger, she knew. Daddy? She had asked, forcing herself to remain calm despite already welling tears. Somewhere around Oklahoma, she would decide she had known the news before she heard it. She would avoid thinking of precognition, but instead would call it instinct. She would tiptoe around her thoughts, and she would refuse them recognition. It was easier that way. It was always easier that way. It's your sister, he had said. Less than an hour later, she would be on the 15 North, headed first to Barstow in the heart of the Mojave, then veering east. She would keep her window rolled down and a cigarette lit. She would smoke a pack by Arizona and another by New Mexico. She would push through state after state, crossing rivers and mountains and plains. She would cry and laugh. She would sit in silence. A few times, she would switch on the radio, only to grow tired of it too soon to make it worthwhile. She would decide not to bother. She would call her father from a payphone in Missouri, only to get the answering machine, wishing she had hung up sooner to avoid the trivial charge. She would hang up and light another cigarette on the way back to the car. She felt herself sinking somehow as the terrain shifted around her, brown to red and back to brown, sandy soil to moist, dark earth. She could feel the barometric pressure through the glass and sense the mercury's height to the degree. The Nova began to slowly flatten into the earth until they became one, and she was no longer driving. She was circling. She was rotating. She pictured herself as a hump in the concrete, speeding beneath the painted center line, defying time and space and commanding the rising and setting of the sun. Her mind turned to cartoons she had seen as a child, Bugs Bunny swiftly burrowing further and further, deeper and deeper still. She was untouchable. Here, on the road, she was invincible. When she finally piloted her Nova past the faded white sign with the cheerfully small-town etching she could see in her dreams, "Population, one more now!" she broke free and regained a clarity of mind she had forgotten was possible. She pulled her car to a stop outside Freely's Hardware and cursed herself for not stopping to rest somewhere. She tried to remember her journey but could think only in blurred images, a meandering mosaic of the American frontier. She found herself parked on Main Street, a few inches too far from the curb. She was amazed she had pulled even that off. Her engine hissed and clicked censure at her for the brutalizing it had taken as she sat, hands folded in her lap. She hadn't realized she was crying again. 3. Ellen was subtly aware of an airplane overhead, an escape to parts unknown, when a loud rapping on the car window next to her ear startled her. She snapped her head up, instinctively wiping her eyes as she did so. She found herself looking into the face of a police officer, a young one, she gathered. From his face, she figured he couldn't be more than 25. His greased black hair was cropped close to his head in a naive mimicry of presumed authority, and he had the grimmest of looks on his face. He motioned with his hand to roll down the window, simulating the movement, his gloved mitt slowly circling in the air. She imagined a dog paddling water and giggled slightly. He noticed. She rolled the window down. "You can't park like this," he spat sternly through the open window. "I'm sorry." "You're too far from the curb." She realized then how seriously this man took his job. She felt sorry for him in a way, but oddly envious. He had a position of importance, of respect, and despite the mockery of the local children, Ellen was sure he ably carried himself through town with a dignity most men never find. Behind him, his cruiser sat idling on the other side of the road. He had turned the lights on when he stopped. She giggled again to herself. "Ma'am, do you hear me?" "Yes, I'm sorry. I'll try this again." She straightened herself in her seat and moved to start the car, shaking her head a bit to clear it. The last thing she needed was a roadside sobriety test. She imagined she'd fail. Her hand lighted on the ignition. "California, huh?" She stopped again and looked up as he said this, a questioning look on her face, confusion and a lack of recognition clouding her thoughts further. She forced herself to think. To think. Damn it. The officer was now looking at her car, perhaps marveling that it had made it in one piece. "Where are you headed?" She focused. "Right here, officer." He continued looking away from her, at the hood of the car, searching for some answer in the faded paint, the corrosion, the 3,000 miles of silt and soil. The officer turned back to her and asked clearly, "You have your license with you?" Ellen sighed and reached for her bag on the seat next to her. He watched curiously as she hastily searched. She had never liked purses, found them awkward things of more social importance than functionality. At a very early age, she had taken to carrying a plain black canvas satchel, and though that first one had worn out long ago, she had kept the habit. She pulled her license forth and pushed it to him through the open window. He studied it for a moment, then looked back at her. The cop smiled, and Ellen frowned. This was going too far for her. She needed sleep. Christ, sleep. "Well, shit. Ellen Williams, how the hell are you?" Her brow crumpled up a bit as his demeanor broke, and he leaned in a bit. "You don't look a bit different, you know that?" She frowned, then glanced down to the polished golden name tag pinned to the breast of his uniform. Skirbish. She laughed loudly, delirium catching up with her. 2 days on the road. 2 days in her Nova, barreling across earth and sky, time and space, memory, all toward the dim horizon. "Jesus Christ, Ron! I'm sorry, Officer Skirbish." She recognized him fully now. Skirbish was a few years younger than she, the brother of a boy in her high school class. She was surprised she hadn't recognized him at first. Ronnie Skirbish had always been the child who snuck off at lunch in sixth grade to smoke cigarettes behind the building. His brother was no angel either, and by his freshman year of high school, young Ronnie was smoking more pot and drinking more beer than those Ellen's age. Ellen supposed it was fitting that a decade after high school he'd make a living confiscating marijuana and interrupting teenage sex. She looked up at his short, buzzed hair and began to laugh again. Skirbish handed the license back through the window to her and continued, "How long has it been since you were back in the valley, Ellen?" Her laughing subsided long enough for her to spit out, "Years." He played along a minute, quietly laughing himself as he tapped his fingers on the door of the car. He feigned understanding. Ellen feigned control. When she had calmed down a bit, he leaned in closer. "You want a cup of coffee?" She took deep breaths and forcefully subsided the laughter. She looked up at him a minute, remarking to herself once again how young he looked. "Yeah, that would be nice. That would be very nice." 4. No one saw it coming, Ellen. Ron Skirbish's words hung with her, on her, like a heavy cloak as Ellen pulled her tired car to a stop on the street outside her childhood home. Nobody in the town saw it coming. She couldn't believe it. How could she? Surely a sign, something. Surely some moment of unhappiness, some cloud of despondence, had made a brief occurrence at some point over the past 30 years. As a child, her sister had never bothered concealing her feelings, had not, in fact, seemed to have a shred of compunction. She had hidden nothing, as far as Ellen knew, her whole life. Ellen looked out her window and up at the modest Victorian house behind the well-manicured and leaf-covered lawn. 333. She had forgotten the address, navigated on instinct and memory. How could she have forgotten the address? A wooden-handled rake leaned against the front of the house. Its metal prongs dug shallow divots in the soft earth of her father's flower bed. She noticed he had dug out the bulbs, and she was sure they were piled in a wheelbarrow in the garage. A month from now, they'd end up in a pair of white plastic pails in the basement, where they would patiently wait for spring like everyone else. Year after year, the ritual continued. It was more than cyclic. She drove past her sister's apartment on the way through town. She knew it only as an address scribbled on a small piece of paper. Ella knew she would have to return there soon enough. She would have to enter the place and be confronted by a life not hers, a life not anyone's, not anymore. She would have to know. Ellen opened the door and stepped out, her step faltering a bit on the cracked pavement. She looked down and thought, "Jesus, the roads here are horrible," then reached over to lock the door, giggled, and closed it without doing so. She realized now how badly she needed sleep, but figured she could pull a few more hours out of herself yet if she had to. She crossed the street cautiously, looking both ways out of habit, and stepped onto the grass of her father's lawn. A light breeze was blowing down the street, and the smell of the leaves was intoxicating. She closed her eyes and took it in, thinking of how strange an experience it was. This was the time of year she used to dread, after all, and the fragrance of dead, dry leaves would once have turned her mood sour. She looked again at the rake, then at the three neatly lined brass numbers tacked to the side of the house. 333. She smiled and approached the door. Her finger, surprisingly steady, reached out and slowly pushed in the small, yellowed button next to the door. She heard a familiar tone ring within and looked back out across the yard. It was just as she remembered it, somehow. Nothing had changed. After all she'd been through, after trials and tribulations thousands of miles away, this place was the same. It fascinated her that despite complications in her life elsewhere, there was a certainty here she'd forgotten. She wished to explore the thought further, but realized it was exhaustion that was preventing her. At the notion, a yawn escaped her. She covered her mouth and swayed a bit. God, it had been so long since she felt a bed. Her mind reeled back to her departure from L.A., and it seemed like eons had passed. Sleep seemed foreign to her, a thing other people did, but not she. No, she was a wanderer, a traveler, and this quest would not end. She turned back to the door as the latch clicked on the other side, and she was suddenly nervous, suddenly and inexplicably terrified. She didn't know what to expect, and part of Ellen urged her to turn and run now, just get back in her car and leave. She could go another 2 days, could will herself to push further and further, onward across the same trail. She could be back in Los Angeles by, God, what day was it? The door slowly opened, and an old man smiled down at her. Neither one of them spoke. She took in the lines on his face and the wrinkles around his eyes. His skin was pale, his shoulders hunched. His lips were a light gray, it seemed, thin and light. When had he gotten so fucking old? His hair, jet black in her memories, was now a faded gray, a sandy shrub on the top of his wrinkled head. Ellen. He spoke softly and in a voice she knew better than her own. One word, her name. She smiled back at him and saw her father for the first time. Behind the wrinkles and gray hair, he was still there, not the deformation she first saw. He was there in the eyes, in the voice, and in the agile way in which he moved. She responded, "Hi, Dad." He pushed open the screen door between them and stepped back for her to enter. She hesitated, just a moment, just a fraction of an instant, and then stepped up and passed him into his home, into her home. Ellen wondered if he noticed. She stood there, in the entryway, and heard the door close behind her. She turned to him again and hugged him. Her intention was nothing more than politeness or obligation, but as he hugged her back, her eyes welled up, and she squeezed harder than she ever had. She felt his hand on her back and remembered how it had always dwarfed hers as a child, her small fist fitting comfortably within his worn palm. The hand of a grown-up holding the hand of a child. As he spoke, she heard a tremble in his voice and knew that hers would contain the same when she forced air up from her lungs and into the stale space between them, the years and the memories. "I'm glad you came." 5. They sat opposite one another at the kitchen table. The arrangement was surreally natural for Ellen. As she slid onto the faded wooden chair, she imagined herself as a child in the same spot, knees bent, legs folded beneath her, her elbows resting on the table as she stared across at her father. They sat as adults now, a steaming cup of instant coffee in front of each of them. The arrangement and the implications were both different and the same. They were the same people that had played checkers at this table deep into the night, yet somehow they were not. Could it be that the worn idiom of time's hand slowly reshaping people themselves was true? Ellen's fatigue was setting in hard now, but her father's presence was captivating. She had told herself she would never forgive him, never speak to him again. But as she sat across from him and took in the sight of a tired and broken man wearing faded overalls, she felt a calmness she didn't think existed. There was a sort of apotheosis here. There was benign revelation in the faded denim, in the graying hair. For his part, he was far less intimidating than he ever had been. His worn hands now wore wrinkles as well as calluses, and he could tell by the way she had caught her breath at his sight that he had aged, and considerably. Beyond his years, perhaps. What frightened him most of all, though, was that his daughter was here, just across the table from him, and he had nothing he could say to her. He had hoped she would return, and a part of him always knew that someday she would, and he had spent countless nights reciting the words he would speak in his head. He had rehearsed the words to the point of their meaning's degradation. They had become lines, he saw that now, as thin as paper, as easily smudged as newsprint. It troubled him that he could not articulate his feelings to his oldest daughter, despite his best effort. What lay between them was not something he could so easily embrace or dismiss. The lines and the lies had died with his youngest daughter. George Williams looked up at Ellen, admiring the woman she'd become and seeing the girl she'd been. He could detect in her traces of her mother, her high cheekbones, her thin nose, the way her lips wrinkled as she pressed them together. This thought more than any other brought him tremendous sorrow, as he had once seen the same traits in both his daughters. It had been a comfort to him, all those years, that their mother had somehow followed them despite her death. Now, perhaps, that illusion would fade as well. Perhaps not. Reaching. How was your drive, Ellen? She laughed. Part of it was instinct. She had grown accustomed to laughing at irony, despite its humor or lack thereof. Part of it was sheer exhaustion. I haven't slept in days, she answered. Then abruptly, who was the father? It caught them both off guard, and a moment later, Ellen's eyes drifted down to the pattern laid by God in the wood of the table's top. She traced it with her shifty, tired eyes, wishing she'd said nothing at all. It was a question which had been on the lips of all in the town, a question George had been softly asked more than once in recent days. The truth was, he didn't know. No one knew. He wasn't sure she had known, but this was not something he wished to share with Ellen, not now. He frowned, not knowing how to respond. He wanted to comfort her and wished there was something he could say, something he could do to lessen the strain on her. Instead, he turned the corners of his mouth up into a smile. Ellen saw this and smiled as well before ejaculating laughter. George followed suit and they laughed together over their coffee, two adults across a kitchen table. Two old friends, perhaps, rehashing tales of glory and honor over steaming testaments to decaying life. Go to bed, Ellen. Your room is clean. Without answering, laughter unremitting, she stood, took her cup to the sink, and headed for the stairs. She touched his shoulder lightly as she went, and he listened to her laughter transform into giggles as she ascended the steep flight of stairs at the end of the hall. He heard her footsteps cross the foyer at the top of the stairs, enter her childhood bedroom, and stop as she collapsed onto the bed. He knew she was asleep before her head hit the pillow, and the thought made him smile again against the maddening insecurity creeping into every nerve. There were rough times behind them, and rough times ahead. George stood and crossed to the sink. He placed his coffee cup next to his daughter's, picked her keys up from the table, and went outside to bring in her bags. Upstairs, in the bed which had held her as a child, Ellen Williams finally slept. 6. As Ellen slept, fully clothed and sprawled on top of the neatly made bed, the town outside was settling down. The people were acclimating to fall. It was, in more ordinary years, a long process, yet this year the delay of fall's onset caused them all to rush into it, perhaps unprepared. The yard work was drawing to a close. The children came in earlier every evening. Surprisingly, most of the townspeople had moved on from the death of the girl they had watched grow up. This coldness wasn't entirely unusual, but it surprised George, nonetheless. He suspected, though, that it still hovered over all of them, and their coldness was nothing more than shallow concealment of the truth. One of their own, and she had been one of them, had taken her own life. They hadn't seen it coming. They hadn't been there for her. They had watched it happen right under their noses and done nothing. What this said about the town and the people was something they wished to ignore, he imagined. The changes were subtle, however, and George guessed Ellen would never notice without his pointing them out. He wasn't sure he would. He wasn't sure he could speak of these things to his daughter. The town was forcing itself to move on. Her death was nothing more than a single faltered step in the dance of small-town life. George Williams sat alone at his kitchen table and laughed to himself at the irony of the town's age-old axiom. He couldn't help but laugh as time crept up and slowly passed him. He glanced up at the clock and thought, not for the first time that day, that he should wake Ellen. She had fallen asleep 20 hours earlier and showed no signs of waking. He hadn't heard even a creak of the house's old wood emanate from her room. He watched the second hand slowly drift across the face of the clock. He listened carefully for birds through the open window, but heard none. Autumn was indeed here. There was work to do. He should wake Ellen. In front of him, the clock's hands turned slowly, as if they were each burdened by a great weight. He'd give her until dark. He'd wake her and ask her if she wanted to head to the steakhouse for dinner. They'd talk of old times, perhaps, of her mother and sister. Maybe they'd even mention the unbearable, ugly truth which lay between them. Maybe they'd speak of her sister's death, of what was to be done. Maybe they'd stay in tonight. Days go by. They always do. 7. Ellen was 12 when her mother died, on the verge of a tumultuous period of self-awakening called adolescence. It was here, in this netherworld between child and adult, that a tragedy could be most disastrous. It was in this place that the repercussions of such an event could last a lifetime. Her sister was too young to grasp the full impact of the event. Death to her was still a mystery, and as such, no real-life effects could be inferred. It birthed only confusion and, eventually, reluctant acceptance. It birthed a slow disregard. Catherine Williams was a beautiful woman, always had been, and she truly was the light of her husband's life. Her smile could still freeze him, her touch still gave him shivers. Her children idolized her as well, thought her a saint. For all intentions and purposes, she was. At night, after Catherine had tucked them in, they would often stay up listening to their parents converse, mesmerized. Muffled words in hushed tones carried through walls and heating ducts, floating down to them and filling them with voyeuristic glee and, sometimes, a pang of guilt. But it was exciting. It was only here, in the dead of night, when the children were presumed sleeping, that the elder pair could be seen as real people by Ellen. During the day, they were parents. They conducted their parental tasks, occasionally sharing a moment between the two of them, but for the most part intently focused on their children. But at night, they could speak as adults, as lovers, as friends, and this never ceased to fascinate Ellen. This particular night, George and Catherine had gone out to dinner, their monthly date. There was no particular occasion. They made it a point to get out once a month, just the two of them. It had gotten easier now that Ellen was old enough to watch her sister, and perhaps they had stayed a little longer than they should have, consumed too much wine. It was near midnight as they climbed into their car to head home. George drove, as he always did, and Catherine looked out the window as they laughed and enjoyed their last few minutes together. He slid his hand across the seat and onto her thigh. In return, she leaned over and kissed his neck. He smiled, intoxicated by her warmth. "Maybe we should wait until we get home." He spoke the meaningless words as an obligatory function. He had no intention of stopping her as she continued to kiss and playfully nibble at his neck. She looked up one last time at him, a wide smile stretching across her face, and he told her how beautiful she was. He meant it. Without a word, she unfastened her seatbelt and lowered her head, slowly unzipping his slacks, teasing him. His hand moved from her thigh to her back as she continued. He marveled at the situation and counted himself lucky that his marriage had somehow avoided the confines into which most fell. As she took him into her mouth, he closed his eyes. It was a reflex. He was powerless. It was as conscious as breathing, yet the act would haunt him. As the road curved, the blind car continued straight on its course, a course which intersected with that of a pulp truck headed the opposite direction. The two collided, and in an instant all was gone. A flash, the screech of metal digging and singing, and the world collapsed in upon itself. George was dead. He was sure of that. The next time George opened his eyes, he was facing the ceiling of a hospital room. He was a widower, and he turned his head slowly to see through a glass door his motherless children sitting outside, accompanied by a police officer. He tried to turn his head further, to survey the room for his wife, his love, but a sharp pain in his neck prevented it. A nurse appeared above him, and he whispered her name, knowing before the answer came what it would be. He began to cry, and then never stopped, not really. The tears left indelible stains on a face that would soon be pulled and stretched into a map of hard lines, a map of grief and grieving. The truth of the accident never came out, of course, for the benefit of the children. It was a foggy night. The pulp truck driver admitted to having 30 hours on the road without sleep, and while his blood alcohol level was well below the legal limit, George Williams had wine on his breath when medics arrived on the scene. It was never questioned. It was written off as an accident, plain and simple, with no blame placed. All parties were at fault, including God. No blame officially placed, but George would carry the undeniable weight the rest of his life. He would wish again and again that he had died that night, and the thought of leaving his living children only filled him with that much more guilt, pain, and regret. For Ellen's part, the damage was done. She needed to find fault and place blame. Her father was all but dead to her. Their relationship became a series of silent meetings in the kitchen and living room. They didn't speak for a month. As she became a teenager, her grief personified itself in the form of rampant rebellion, and she made no attempt to hide her promiscuity or experimentation with drugs. George was helpless, of course, though he tried to vocalize to her his concern. She, in turn, replied with wanton cruelty. When confronted with the birth control pills George found in the bathroom, she replied simply, "I like to fuck." When he caught her smoking pot in the same bathroom, the window cracked open in a half-hearted attempt to escape detection, she laughed and blew the smoke in his face. He knew by the time she was a senior in high school that she was all but lost to him, but her bitterness transcended usual teenage angst. He could hardly blame her. He blamed himself, of course. She graduated high school, spent a summer working as a waitress in town, and left. She never returned. She never called. And George's only contact with her was in the form of updates he received from her sister, with whom Ellen still spoke occasionally. He had all but written off any chance of reconciliation until Cassie's death, and even then, a part of him didn't know if she'd come. But she did come. She had come, and they had spoken, and he felt like anything was possible now. But he knew it was still there, that it would always be there. He felt the distance between them, perhaps larger than any before. Perhaps it was because she was here again. He was confronted with it for the first time in a decade. Her sister's death may have changed something in her, opened her to something, but the past couldn't be altered. He would wait. He would let her choose her next step. He would not make the same mistake twice. 8. He was so absorbed in this remembrance that he hadn't heard her wake up. It wasn't until the front door swung shut behind her that he realized she was awake. He leaned forward and craned his neck, just making out her shoulder on the front porch. She was sitting down. George stood up, poured two glasses of iced tea, and walked outside to join his daughter. How long have I been sleeping?
About 20 hours.
Here. He handed her the glass, and she took it gratefully. She had lit a cigarette, and George looked down to see an engraved lighter resting on the pack beside her.
EW.
You get that for yourself?
I take my habits seriously. I'm a professional.
She smiled.
He loved it. He loved to see her smile.
It wasn't enough that she was here. He had to see her happy. He had to make her happy.
How long have you been smoking?
He asked, already knowing the answer. It wasn't the answer he was looking for, but the acknowledgement. He reveled in it. He basked in it like a lizard, greedily spreading himself thin to absorb as much as possible.
About 15 years, she answered matter-of-factly, as if it was perfectly natural. She was 30 years old.
He nodded his head.
I figured.
You sleep well?
Like the dead. I barely remember going upstairs last night.
She looked up then and continued.
And here it is getting dark again.
George looked up with her then.
Can I have one of those?
She looked at him and laughed. When she saw he was serious, she shrugged and pushed the pack toward him. She took a drag from her own as he lit his.
I thought you quit decades ago.
He dragged deeply and coughed.
Yeah, it's been a while.
They sat and smoked in silence. George didn't cough after the first drag, and she noted that he, too, was a professional, a little rusty though he may have been. She still felt uncomfortable around him, but decided that this was pleasant, and that was all right. Ellen finished her cigarette and ground it out on step. She held it up to him questioningly. He shrugged.
Just toss it in the yard. Nobody's going to complain.
She did so, and a second later he followed suit. She upended her iced tea, emptying the last of it.
You want a refill?
Ellen nodded, and the two stood, one a little more slowly than the other. In the kitchen, George filled both their glasses, leaving an inch at the top. Ellen moved to grab hers, but George stopped her and grinned. He reached into a cabinet and produced a bottle of scotch. She retracted her hand and smiled again. She was surprised by just how often she had let happiness creep onto her face, surprised at how genuine it was. She was trained to mask emotion and to forth a kind of monotonous contentment that was both unthreatening and unenthusiastic. The real world had forced this upon her years ago, and they were together to bury her sister after all.
This is how we do it out here in the sticks, honey.
He filled the remainder of both glasses, then took a sip from the bottle. He passed it to her.
Warm up.
She did the same and handed the bottle back to him, wiping her mouth with her free hand. She exhaled heavily, a breathy approval. As he was replacing the scotch in the cabinet, he spoke to her, his back turned, his voice low.
You want to sit out in the backyard?
He said it softly, knowing it may be too much, maybe too forward. It was an invitation not only into the backyard, but to take the next step toward an intimacy long lost. Ellen nodded and answered, surprisingly at ease,
sure.
She sipped her drink and walked to the back door. George watched her go. He pulled a folded lawn chair from inside the garage and set it next to one already prepared.
Usually don't have company out here.
He took his seat and she took hers, both pointing subtly inward toward one another. Ellen lit a cigarette and offered one to her father. He accepted graciously.
You never answered my question, she said, looking out into the growing darkness.
George looked down. He had known it would come, but was hoping she would forget she had asked previously. He was hoping the exhaustion would act as a magic spell, a cleansing ritual. He was hoping...
What question was that?
You know damn well. Her tone wasn't unfriendly, but the intention was not hidden. Not at all. Ellen held on to enough bitterness to allow her to go unquestioningly forward, always forward. It had gotten her through hard times,
and her predisposition to downplay any emotional attachment had come in handy more than once. She supposed it was a symptom of some greater problem in her life, but embraced it when needed. She could be a bitch. She knew it, and at times she cherished it. Ever forward. She wouldn't say. She wouldn't tell you? I don't think she told anyone. She had a boyfriend. She told you? I got a letter about 6 months ago. She had fallen in love, whatever that means. I didn't know. I never knew her to have any boyfriends, not really. Not to say she wasn't liked, she just kept to herself. Ellen finished his sentence. He supposed he had expected her to do just that. Ellen shook her head. I don't get it. Why wouldn't she tell one of us? Why wouldn't she talk to someone when she was in trouble? Maybe she did, he answered. And the statement had a weight he hadn't expected. 9. As Ellen stared up at the ceiling, trying desperately to fall asleep, the sky slowly shifting from black to a dull gray-blue outside her window, a strange memory flew into her head with the intensity of a sparrow into a plate-glass window. It stuck there for a moment, then began to slowly slide down, its details making themselves disgustingly visible to her, blood and brain running down the glass. She thought of teenage nights spent in the very room, the very bed which she now occupied. She thought of the gentle touch she gave herself. She thought of burying her head sideways in the pillow to conceal her soft moaning. She thought of the wet spot in which she so often fell asleep. She had embraced masturbation the moment she discovered it, and by the end of high school it was nightly ritual. Often she would think of boys from school. Their faces would float past her in the dark as she slowly and delicately massaged, her fingers tracing their features onto her own legs and stomach. A few times she had thought of her close girlfriends, but guilt had pushed them out of her head within moments of climax. More than once, after a date, she would come home, crawl into bed, and envision what she'd just done. She'd think of it objectively, like she were watching it on television. She'd see herself kissing. She'd see the awkward groping, the naive and sticky fumbling. She'd see her taking him into her mouth. As she thought of these things, she'd quietly pull off her clothes and search with her tongue for remnants of his taste. With the deed done, she'd pull a patch of sheet over the dampness beneath her and turn on her side to look out the window. She did that now. She faced out the window and listened to the light wind and the first car doors of the day slamming shut. She thought of repeating the act now and of the pleasure it would bring, but decided against it. Some things, she thought, were better left to memory. 10. They arrived at Wurlitz's funeral home, father and daughter, early the next morning. Ellen was tired. She hadn't slept, yet she had awakened late enough the day before to still be on her toes. Enough, that is, to deal with what she had to deal. The two were greeted nearly at the door by Fred Wurlitz himself, his ample barbecue belly hanging over his belt by a good 6 inches. Wurlitz's jacket hung lifelessly on his large frame like a dead, wet fish, and Ellen noticed the bottom two buttons of his dress shirt straining feebly against his girth, against his presence. He reached out a hand to George and pulled him in for an awkward hug. Such is the way things were done in a small town, Ellen mused. Wurlitz then turned his attention to Ellen. He stared at her a moment, his eyes filled with the generic over-the-counter grief he carried for all his clients. Then he put his hands on her shoulders and pulled her into him. Ellen, so glad you came. She was puzzled then, her arms lazily ascending to wrap themselves around his hearty back. His tone related a familiarity with which she couldn't connect. She thought of prying herself loose and demanding Wurlitz show some professionalism. She opted instead to feign appreciation for his gesture, hiding her discomfort, hiding her, yes, it was, her fear. Glad I could come. The words were all he needed, and he let go, immediately looking to George. Ellen stood between them and felt like a child in the midst of adult affairs. The two men exchanged a few words she didn't catch and then walked off. George looked back at her. She smiled and sat down. This was not her business, after all. George followed Wurlitz into his office, and Ellen watched the door shut behind them. She looked around, surveying her surroundings. Kitschy carpeting covered the floor of the small entryway, trying to push the walls out and give the illusion of comfortable space. Ellen sat in one of two upholstered chairs, a small table between them. Across from her, another end table held a beige lamp. The weak bulb seemed to give out nothing more than a sad, dirty glow, and Ellen wondered if there was a mandate on dreary atmosphere in such establishments. She stood and walked through a pair of oak doors, her feet padding gently on worn green carpet. Before her, rows of chairs filled a small room. There were probably 20 chairs in all, and what she could only describe as an altar at the front of the room. She crossed to it, letting her gaze wander across the wallpaper as she did so. Muted floral patterns spun across every wall, their inked vines and leaves tracing every contour, meeting in the corners. There were no windows, and again a small beige lamp provided inadequate illumination. Ellen looked down at the small rectangular table at the front of the room. It stood about waist high, but was no more than 3 feet across. The only object on its dark surface was a felt-lined book. She opened the cover and saw in an elegant hand, Ethel Friedlander. She knew what it was immediately, but turned the pages nonetheless. She read a few of the inscriptions, but passed over most. All were short, a name or two, an address, and a single sentence calling out the author's fondness for the deceased. A few had a telephone number, but most did not. She wondered why it had been left behind after the mourners, the flowers, and the guest of honor, Ethel Friedlander herself, had been ushered out, carried out to parts unknown. Ellen moved through another set of oak doors and entered what was by far the largest room of the building. Along each wall, polished caskets were lined up, their lids open to display their plush interiors. She stopped as she saw, and wondered how enticing that really could be. How much of an impact does the comfort of the interior have on a coffin's purchaser? She supposed it had more than it should. It was then that Ellen remembered Fred Wurlitz, decades younger but no thinner. She was just a girl then, and she remembered her father following Wurlitz into his office as she sat with her sister in the upholstered chairs of the entryway. Cassie had played silently with a doll, but Ellen was old enough to recognize the oppressive air of death in the place. She had followed the same route then, ending in the same spot. She had stood frozen, staring at a wall lined with coffins. But they weren't just coffins, were they? They were vehicles. Ellen. She turned to find her father standing behind her. Daddy. It's time to go now, honey. 11. George and Ellen arrived at Gray's Monument Company half an hour later. They rode in silence, Ellen smoking several cigarettes along the way. George watched her out of the corner of his eye as he drove. She was still an enigma to him. He wished that she would open herself and let him see what was going on inside her head. He wished she would say something with or without words to let him know how she was feeling, but he imagined her state was more complex than anything he could so easily figure out. It had been a roller coaster since she arrived. It was pleasant. There were no blow-ups. There were no fights. But her mood shifted as ceaselessly as the seasons had. She was a constant mystery to him, allowing glimpses into her demeanor but never her thoughts. He felt as if she spoke in code, but he was happy to have her here, nonetheless. Gray's Monument had occupied the same storefront for over 30 years. It sat at the edge of downtown, on Main Street, but far enough from the tourists to keep everyone happy. The large window at the front of the store displayed half a dozen varieties of stones, all the same dull gray, all bearing a smooth square on their front. They awaited death the same way the open, empty caskets at Wurlitz's funeral home did. It was their business, their purpose. The people of the valley still very much viewed their home as the quintessential American small town, a family of families unto itself. So many of the neighboring towns had transformed themselves into bedroom communities, housing the well-to-dos looking to get a break from city life. But here, the bread-and-butter American lifestyle had never changed. As such, involvement in every aspect of life, and death, was expected and status quo. It was not at all unusual to stop by the engraver of your recently deceased child's tombstone to say hello and check the progress. In fact, people here cherished the ability to do such things. It was their way of staving off the assembly line mentality of the outside world. The small bell above the door Ellen remembered as a child was replaced years earlier with a sleek electronic device. As George opened the door for her to enter, it emitted a barely audible tone a second or two in length. She guessed the sound came from the back of the shop, where someone was hard at work making their living and scribing other people's death onto slabs of marble and slate, digging and chipping away to carve out a legacy, to carve out what would be left behind. An old man emerged through a door at the back of the front room a minute later, wiping his hands with a white cloth. He smiled as he saw George.
"George Williams, glad you could come by."
He extended a hand, and George took it. Ellen smiled, awaiting her turn. The old man turned to her, and she recognized him immediately. His hair had grayed, his face was a map of a lifetime of hard work, but in his eyes was a vision from her past. She held out her hand to him. "Ellen Williams, I don't know if you remember me."
The old man chuckled and replied, "Of course I do, of course. You're a bit taller now."
Her smile widened. She appreciated the genuine way his words came. They were soft and calming, the way lotion felt on a sunburn.
"And a few years older," she said. "I've been working on it all morning, just about finished her up, if you want to come and take a look," the old man said.
He was looking at Ellen, but speaking to both of them. George looked down at her. "I think I'll pass," she said. "I'll be outside." "Okay. I'll just be a minute." George reached out and touched her face lightly before following the old man back through the store. His hand was warm and controlled, and in that moment Ellen admired him. She knew he took no more pleasure in such activities than she did, but he understood their place and respected the institutions of the small-town culture. Involvement. Ellen wondered where he got his strength, how this old man, so worn by a lifetime of loss and disappointment, could stand tall when he needed to. She turned slowly and stepped outside. The weak electronic tone wafted through the store again. Ellen sat down on the trunk of her father's car and lit a cigarette. It was chilly today, in the 40s. She was glad. It was a welcome change for her, and she once again noted to herself her changed attitude toward autumn. It was decades earlier that Ellen and her sister had come here with their father. The task was the same, to check the progress made on the grave marker, the final statement of her mother. She had been bitter then, resentful, and she had wished to shout, to scream out,
"How is this fitting? How does this help? How can this be a tribute? This cold stone is not a person," she had spat out in her head.
The words had been forceful, even as silent accusations, and she had done then what she did now. She had left. She had sat outside while the adults within did their business. She felt alone, lonely. She felt herself, for the first time, missing her sister, not just the idea of her. They hadn't seen each other in years, rarely spoke. But in this time and space, she sensed the void left by Cassie's terminated presence. Anger crept in her. She took a deep drag from her cigarette and silently cursed. She would be fine, she knew that. Time would roll on and wounds would heal. They always did. No, she would be fine. Days go by, after all. But she wondered, for how long is being fine enough? 12. George took the long way home, winding around town on narrow country roads. Quaint farms dotted the hills, and Ellen marveled at the color. She had driven through the countryside on her way into town, but had been so focused on her destination that she hadn't noticed the beauty outside her car. Now she took it all in, rolling the window down to let the crisp, perfumed air blow across her face. It was a pleasant silence which George broke. "When do you think you'll head back, Ellen?"
"The first of the month," she replied easily.
"Day after Halloween. Good that you'll be here for that. That was always our favorite holiday."
She looked at him, saw that the cheer in his voice was forced. She frowned slightly, pity, perhaps.
"Yeah, I'll be here for Halloween. Maybe we can go trick-or-treating."
Her joke hit home, and George chuckled, then looked over at her. He put his hand on her knee. Maybe. Don't know that I have a costume, though. Then, hey, why don't we carve some pumpkins? We'll be passing that pick-your-own place in a minute here. We could do that tonight. It's not too early. He motioned out her window at a farm. As the White House's porch streaked through her vision, Ellen distinctly saw a handful of jack-o'-lanterns arranged on the front steps. Can't tonight. What, you got a hot date or something? Kind of. I don't know. He looked at her and she blushed a bit. Nothing spectacular, but I ran into someone the other day. He wants to take me out tonight. Can't imagine there's much to do around here. A date? Jesus. Been in town a couple days and you're already dating. No one on the other coast? He approached the subject gently, with an air of nonchalance in his inflection, but it was something he'd been meaning to ask since she'd arrived. To say the situation wasn't welcoming of his question would be untruthful, but he still felt a tinge of guilt. George didn't feel it was his place to pry. On top of that, he understood what a delicate situation their relationship was. The air between them was light, and they were getting along, but he knew that before she left they would have to confront what had driven them apart. They would have to speak of Ellen's mother. George knew they would also have to speak of what had finally brought them back together, at least spatially. They hadn't done so yet, not really. The car gently slid past a thick patch of woods, a single rutted drive bisecting it, heading into a darkness not permeated by sun or sky. Ellen's eyes tried to follow the road into the trees, but it disappeared from sight too quickly, just like everything else, she supposed. And then a memory hit her. Childhood, before her mother's death. She had been to that place, had walked that rutted road through the woods. It led through the forest, a winding route, and up a hill, at the top of which was an overgrown clearing broken by rudimentary stone structures, temples to an ancient deity, perhaps. But they weren't. The truth was that the stone marvels, painstakingly pieced together by someone Ellen had never met, were the ruins of a simple homestead, a turn-of-the-century farm, one of the first settlers in the area. The farmer working the adjacent field now owned the land, but the foundations remained, long ago cleansed of their accoutrements by fire, weather, and the gray, sweeping hand of time itself. The area was a place well known to most of the children in the area, especially those of Ellen's generation and those before. At once the name glided into her head and out of her mouth, softly as her breath itself. The Hollow. George turned, confused. She looked at him and was once again in the car, gliding slowly past tree and field. Ellen spoke gently and without reproach the careful words. There's someone. There have been, I guess. Nothing too serious. Not right now. She turned to look out the window again, and George knew better than to push it further. She would talk to him eventually. He hoped she would. 13. The first 15 minutes of Ellen's date with Ron Skirbish was spent, on her part, trying not to break out into laughter. It wasn't that she found him oafish, or that she didn't respect him, although those thoughts did enter her mind at first. Rather, the situation itself struck her as so improbable and ironic that she felt she had no choice but to confront the ridiculousness of it all with laughter. Guttural, unfettered laughter. She managed to contain herself. Skirbish launched into story after story of encounters with drunk drivers, irresponsible firework use, the truancy of the town's school-aged children. Perhaps, she reasoned, if he couldn't break the ice, he would wait for it to melt. Eventually it did, and Ellen was no longer stifling giggles with her napkin. Skirbish was either too obtuse or too self-involved to notice. She didn't hold it against him, figuring it was an effective enough self-defense mechanism when you lived in the valley. She had used it herself when she was younger. By the time their entrees arrived, Skirbish had wound down to relating short anecdotes, all sliding effortlessly from one to the next, all relating in some way to the gratification he felt fighting evil in a small town. He figured he was keeping the people safe, keeping the American dream alive. Ellen, for her part, was content just listening. She wasn't really in the mood to talk, anyway, especially since he would surely be subtly probing her for details of her life in California, and, of course, of her return to the valley and her sister's death. No, she was just fine listening to him. Occasionally she would interject, usually to correct some small grammatical error he made. It didn't seem to bother him, and she got a kick out of watching him brush it off like a gnat and continue unabated. She studied her surroundings carefully,
contrasting them with the world she had come to know outside, in the big city. They were dining at the Route 29 Steakhouse, the only restaurant of any prestige in the area. The patrons were certainly dressed up, but there seemed to be a strict, unspoken dress code. No ties, no formal wear at all, really, except on prom night, when the steakhouse was filled with chatting teenagers, most of whom were eager to dispense with the formality and instruct the driver of their rented limousine to park near the lake. The atmosphere was dark and smoky, with deeply tinted red candle holders in the center of each table. The light was dim, the chatter was loud, and through an open door at the front of the dining room, Ellen could hear a football game in the adjacent bar. It was the combination of these trivialities that formed the rich stew of small-town life. There was a certain informality to it, casual dress and casual attitudes, yet at the center of it all was a protocol to be followed. It was a game, she knew that. Each day's events were scheduled, whether the participants knew it or not. Heading to the only nice restaurant in town was far from routine, yet those dining there partook in an age-old custom. It was an event, and as such there were rules. She leaned forward and spoke, cutting him off. I fucking love it here. He looked a little startled at first, then smiled. Good, good. I do too. I don't come here very often, but when I do, it's an event. Ellen giggled at this. Skirbish didn't follow, but offered a chuckle himself. Good food. Ellen continued. Great fucking food. Jesus. She had chosen her words carefully, in part to gauge his reaction. Certainly he wasn't used to such abrasiveness, but he handled it well. Ellen cut into her steak, suddenly excited to be part of something otherwise foreign to her. Somehow, though, despite the years, it was familiar and reassuring. She took a bite. Skirbish watched her, deeply amused. "Must not have very good food in California," he said. She pointed her fork at him, now completely comfortable with not acknowledging the strict formalities employed elsewhere in the country. "I'm on to you, Ron. Not right now. I don't want to talk about all that now. I'm so tired of thinking about it, about thinking of what I have to do when I get back. I've got enough to weigh on my mind as it is, you know?" He nodded cheerfully, but she could see he was disappointed. His play hadn't worked. She would remain silent. Ellen continued, "Tell me more about your job." She decided halfway through the night that she would sleep with him if he tried. She was no virgin, after all, and the night had been such a pleasant diversion from the almost unthinkable seriousness and severity of what had brought her to this place that she figured it would be a nice way to wrap it up. In the end, he didn't try. He dropped her off at home, offering a peck on the cheek, and she figured she had been a bit too much for him. She shrugged it off. Her date with Ron Skirbish was the only thing about this trip which didn't carry with it immense baggage. It was the only thing that seemed to be enjoyable of its own accord. Perhaps she would even try it again. She thanked him for dinner and silently entered the house shortly before midnight. An early evening for her. George had left a note for her on the kitchen table. Nothing much. Just something to let her know that he didn't hold anything against her for spending the evening with Skirbish. She read that subtext more clearly than she read the written words. "Hope your night went well. Get some rest. Tough days ahead. George." Her eyes lingered over his signature. George, not Dad. Her first reaction was disappointment, but she realized that it was his way of alleviating some of the pressure he was sure she was feeling from all angles. No formalities, no guilt. Two adults catching up, at least on the surface. After some thought, she welcomed the gesture and scribbled on the bottom of the note, "Don't let me sleep too late. Ellen." It would be casualness that would deliver them, she thought. They would first have to find a comfortable space between them. Then they could tackle what they needed to tackle. She went upstairs and crawled into bed, slipping out of her clothes and sliding naked under the covers. She closed her eyes and giggled, thinking of the way Skirbish had delicately avoided eye contact with her for the last half hour of the evening. She had certainly been too much for him. Her hand found its way down her body and between her legs, and she welcomed the sleep that would soon come. 14. Ellen found herself exceedingly nervous as she listened to the keys jingling in the lock of the door. She stood a few feet behind her father, a small, sparse yard between them and the street.
The old house towered over them, rising 3 floors into the gray October sky. Each floor, inaccessible from the others, had been carefully reworked years earlier into a single dwelling. It was the poor part of town, she remembered that from her childhood. The idiom, wrong side of the tracks, applied here metaphorically and literally, as the spur that ran the length of the valley lay mere feet from the house's back door. The neighborhood itself was nondescript, not too different from anywhere else in town. The cars along the street were a bit older, the paint on the houses a bit more worn. The pavement of the driveways bore more cracks and weeds, but it was beneath all this that the true flavor of the quarter sat, waiting to be discovered. There was an air of depravity behind the drawn, moth-eaten curtains. The streets seldom echoed the cries of children, and the muted sound of television sets behind glass was the only sound on any given night. Both animal and human traffic avoided the area. No, it wasn't avoidance. It was as if some polarity pushed it away. The faded wood of the steps beneath Ellen's feet looked as if about to give way at any moment, and the broken latticework along the bottom of the house appeared to her as the chipped teeth of a devilish grin. She didn't like it here. She didn't like the atmosphere or the aesthetic, but she supposed that was why she had never chosen to live here. Cassie had been different. "Got it," George said, and he pushed open the door. She stood outside a moment more, reflecting on her surroundings. She recalled bicycling through the neighborhood alone as a child, basking in the thrill of forbidden territory. She also remembered more than one lover who had lived in the area, and she grinned. Strange how memories can float effortlessly from one to the next, cycling through scenes from the past as if a Rolodex with all the structure of a child's sandcastle. The one thing they had in common was their inherent truth. All memories had their basis in real events, however embellished they may be. In fact, Ellen reasoned on more than one occasion, memory was the only constant anyone had. 15. Her eyes took a moment to adjust to the dimness as she entered. She pushed the door shut behind her without looking at it. There was something about the reality of the outside world that she didn't want to permeate the damp darkness of the apartment. She stood a moment and watched her father wander about with the deft familiarity of someone who treads a path already known. For the second time, she found herself envying the man. George crossed immediately to a small end table and dropped his keys onto it next to the answering machine. He stared at it blankly, unable to make the move Ellen knew he wished he could. She stepped to his side and looked down as his finger found its way to the message button. He pushed it slowly. "You have no new messages," an emotionless woman piped back at them in a staccato speech more aptly suited for sports broadcasting than welcoming people into their home. George nodded agreement and walked into the next room. Ellen stared down at the machine for a moment before following. In the inhuman, impersonal, molded plastic of the machine, there was a stillness that resonated through her. The small red LED stared up at her, a lone eye in a dying beast. She reached down and pulled the cord from the wall, watching almost triumphantly as the eye shut, blinked itself out of existence. No messages indeed. Ellen followed her father further into the cavernous dwelling of her dead sister. He went slowly, pushing aside dirty clothing with his feet. The apartment wasn't messy, it wasn't dirty, it was lived in. And in that Ellen found a tragic irony. It wasn't until its occupant's death that an outsider would enter and postulate about the hominess of the place. It was indeed an inviting space, or was at one time. It was open for its size, with large windows looking out to the street. The color, however, was dark, and it lent an oppressive, instant cabin fever upon entering. Cassie had taken great care in decorating, choosing items that represented home, a home. "Have you been back here?" she asked her father, not really wanting to know. "No, this is the first time since it happened." Since it happened. Ellen's mind once again fought back the urge to forego the innocence of tiptoeing and explore their grief through the painfully obvious. "Oh," she replied, and what her father said next surprised her. "Since she died." The curtains were drawn across most of the windows, allowing only small, thin shafts of light to enter. The result was a cross-hatch pattern on every surface, an intricate design comprised of reflection and refraction. The dark carpeting, which Ellen supposed was usually a melancholy wash, took on dimension, and she could see the rise and fall of each individual fiber. The living room contained little, a couch, a chair, an end table, and a coffee table in the center of the room. The table held one lone object, a Tom Petty CD. "Damn the torpedoes," she mused out loud.
"What?"
"Nothing." She smiled down at the cover, her jaded Los Angeles subconscious half expecting to see myriad trails meandering across its surface, shallow cuts made by a razor dissecting powdered recreation. Yet she saw none, and the gentle surprise itself surprised her. She once again missed her sister, the simple life she had chosen for herself. The simple life she had chosen to continue no more. George continued to the kitchen, glancing slightly at the things he saw along the way. There was nothing unusual, and the ordinariness of everything made him sad. Cassie had been lonely, yes. He felt bad for her. More so, he felt bad because she had never broken free of the mold into which she had been born. She had never strived to do so, never even considered a life outside of the valley, outside of the small town where she was born, where she would die. She had lived in a cookie-cutter life in this cookie-cutter apartment, really just a stone's throw from her childhood home. The truth of the matter was that she hadn't taken her own life at all. She had suffocated, slowly and painfully. It is always an easy thing to assign blame. For anything, really. It isn't so much the act as the release it brings. He had begun to blame himself when it happened, as he had blamed himself for so many things in the past. It always came naturally for him, the resting of responsibility solely on himself. And so, when he had received the call, when he first found out, it was easiest for him to sit in silent judgment of himself. Surely some act of parenting, some act of friendship, could have shown Cassie the redemption she unknowingly sought. Surely the task had been his, and he had failed to recognize the severity of it. But, soon enough, he came to realize this wasn't so. It made things easier to blame someone for the death of a child, to have a place to direct anger and grief, even if that is into the mirror. But something told him it was not right to do so now. His daughter's suicide had not been an act of defiance, a lashing out at the ideals he had instilled, but rather an act of desperation on her part. No, while he would feel the stings of guilt as long as he lived, he would not blame. He would not blame himself, and he would surely not blame her. It was in this understanding that the anger had resigned itself to grief, and he had begun, really, to move forward. "And isn't it tragic," he had asked himself, "that you must lose a child to..." But had he gained a child? Furthermore, could he? The question was a paradox, fusing both literal and allegorical meaning. He knew now it was a possibility to reconnect with Ellen, to perhaps move on together, the two of them, content in knowing that the past is the past, merely a bucket of ashes. Yet could he ever regain the child he lost years earlier, in a chapter of his life now as much a dream as a memory? Was making up for lost time a reality or a poetic fantasy? Could the future erase the past? In the kitchen, the salt and pepper shakers stood at attention as they had the night the note was pulled from beneath them. The police had handed the note to George in a sealed envelope with an official stamp across it. He regarded such a stamp as lunacy, to place even so meek a mark of ownership on something not theirs, not his, not anybody's, not any more. He had read it, of course, and he had cried quietly to himself. He imagined now how it must have looked when they found it, gently folded and carefully weighted. It must be found. It would be found. He became aware of Ellen's presence in the room. "She left the note here," he said, pointing to the white porcelain chicken that looked eagerly out at them. He bent over and inspected the chicken's faded beak, noting the salt crystal stuck to it. The chicken, in its infinite wisdom and calming presence of mind, did not seem to care. Ellen nodded and knew that what he did not point out was the bare circle of wood inches from the shakers, a circle the size of a half dollar, which, before the police entered, had been covered by the gaily orange plastic of a prescription bottle. George straightened himself and sighed. not a heavy sigh, but a quick and nearly silent expulsion of breath. He crossed to the refrigerator and opened it. He said nothing, mildly shocked by the emptiness. Nothing. He closed the refrigerator door, focusing instead on a small piece of paper held to the door by a pink magnetic piglet. This note, as well, was written in her clean hand, its letters faded by time and sunlight. How long had it hung? To buy. Food. He smiled at the sarcasm and wondered how long it had been up, why he had never noticed it before. He turned to Ellen, who still stared down at the table. Ellen. She looked up at him. Those are cute, she said, and she regretted it immediately. Not because it would hurt either one of them, but simply because of its needlessness. Wasted words, wasted breath, wasted time. It all adds up. There's a lot of stuff here. We don't have to go through it all today. Maybe next week. I'm going to wait outside, Ellen. Come out whenever. No hurry. Without waiting for a reply, he walked briskly past her and out the door. She wondered for a moment where the anxiety had entered, as he seemed composed enough to her, but she quickly shut the thought out. It was not worth conjecture. She turned to leave, having no intention of standing in the tomb alone. It was then that the thought struck her. She wanted to see her sister's bedroom. She knew it could wait, that she would have to spend enough time in there as it was, but felt compelled for some reason. Just a peek, just a glimpse into the room, just a moment's investigation, a quick, cursory glance, and she would be satisfied. She found the door easily and pushed it slowly open. She didn't turn the handle, the door was not latched. As it swung to reveal the room, Ellen felt something well up in her she hadn't expected. A devastation filled her then, and a disparity at her sister's passing she hoped wouldn't come. She had hoped she would find peace in it, that a panicky sense of claustrophobic loneliness would never overcome her. She didn't cry, no tears came, but she shuddered as if a chill swept over her, as if someone walked over her grave, as the old folks would say. And then she saw the book. It was right in front of her, on the floor just inside the room. It was small, a dime store girl's journal, but seemed to have a weight beyond its mass. She reached in and quickly swept the book up, then stood and left. 16. Ellen had read her sister's poetry before, first when they were children, and then throughout the years found taped letters or written briefly below her signature. It had never been very good, and there was something about that which had always made Ellen sad. Her little writings, meandering things which spoke of life and love with a hollow naivety, had always been Cassie's escape. As such, it was no surprise to Ellen that they had been collected, carefully arranged and categorized into the small volume she had found on the floor. Cassie had been thorough, and had neatly pasted the cleanly sliced sheets of notebook paper into the center of each white page. Ellen imagined there had been a sort of symmetry in her work, not in the literal sense, but in a Dickensian, plight-of-the-common-man sort of way. Cassie tried to organize her torment as a way of rising above it, but her caution had always been her crutch. Caution, Ellen knew, was what kept good poets from being great and mediocre poets from growing in strength. Most of the poems dealt with some asinine subject and submitted it to the page in the most wonderfully saccharine way. Cute rhymes gave way to shallow abstraction. It was the lack of depth and self-exploration that had always bothered Ellen, but she knew that within the neatly pasted pages of the small book was some clue to her sister's anguish. She would just have to look for it. 17.
I hear you shouldn't kiss the Blarney Stone. The man chewed as he spoke, bits of crumbled bacon dropping from the corners of his mouth. He wore both a sweatshirt and a cap, proclaiming his allegiance to a football team Ellen didn't know. His companion turned to him.
Oh yeah? Why is that?
They piss on it.
They piss on it?
They piss on it. The locals. I guess they get a kick out of pissing on it. So when you're over there, just don't kiss the damn thing.
Is it okay to rub it or something?
If you want to rub recycled Guinness.
The two men laughed together. Football man dipped his toast into the runny yolk of his half-eaten eggs. He took a healthy bite,
yolk dripping down his chin, before returning to his plate to mop up the rest. In a booth on the other side of the diner, Ellen and George sat across from one another, empty plates between them. George smiled.
You miss this all?
The local flavor?
You bet.
It was George's idea that they head there for dinner, the small diner in the center of town. Of course Ellen was familiar with it. It was established long before she was, but she was still a bit apprehensive at the idea. This was, after all, where her sister had spent so much of her adult life, carrying plates of runny eggs to middle-aged men, men who filled their clothes as well as the eggs did their bellies. After some gentle prodding, George had convinced her, and here they were. George had grown accustomed to taking at least one meal a week in the diner. It was habit now more than anything, and he had never befriended any of the other regulars. It was his chance to see his younger daughter on a fairly regular basis. They saw each other often, of course, and she came over to the house at least once a month for dinner and a few beers in the backyard. But the normalcy and regularity of his trips to the diner provided him with the stability he needed, a stability he'd always needed. The waitress returned with the check and set it face down at the edge of the table. She centered it between the two of them. George instinctively took it. Ellen didn't stop him. She knew better than to try, and knew also that he would not be offended by her lack of offering. Indeed, it made him feel better.
See you later, George. Then. Shit, Ellen?
Yep, she replied even before looking up. It wasn't the first time, wouldn't be the last, and while familiarity was often a virtue of places like this, she wished to avoid the attention. Plus, it was these people who pushed her away, in their own way. She looked up a second later into the beaming face of... she didn't know.
Don't tell me you don't remember me!
Ellen smiled as the waitress continued.
Monica Dentner, class of 88.
Oh, yeah, Ellen lied. How are you?
I'm just wonderful. I didn't recognize you at first. Been so long.
Monica Dentner nodded in George's direction.
Suppose it makes sense, though.
Ellen looked at her father, using Monica Dentner's feeble motion as an excuse. George gently bit his lower lip. He was amused. Ellen rolled her eyes slightly, a grin at the corners of her mouth.
Oh, I suppose you're here for...
She leaned forward and dropped her voice a bit.
The service and all?
Ellen offered a faux smile and nodded.
Jesus Christ, it's a shame, Monica Dentner continued. I knew Cassie pretty well. We worked together damn near every day for the past however many years.
Ellen wished to retort.
And that means you knew her? If you knew her, why didn't you see she was in pain? Why didn't you see she was lonely? And for fuck's sake, do you really think speaking softly gives you the right to say whatever the fuck you want?
You should stop by one of these nights. We can go get a drink, catch up, or whatever. Ellen nodded again, assuring herself she had no desire at all to speak with Monica Dentner over drinks or anything else. Monica Dentner left, offering a final smile to George, and walked behind the bar, leaning over and flirting with the wish-to-be Irishman. Well, that was colorful, George offered, knowing Ellen's discomfort.
Yeah, fucking pleasant.
George dropped a 10 and a 5 onto the table and followed Ellen out. 18. Water, water, we all know. When it's cold, we call it snow. Cassandra Williams. 19. They both knew the turnout would be minimal. For George, this was a cause of sadness. He wished there could be a line around the block. He wished they had to sell tickets, hire vendors to feed the waiting throng, the mob of mourners. Ellen had always hated funerals, had always hated the false comfort they provided. For her, it was no more than a morbid charade. Friends and loved ones crowded around a wax dummy, pretending they knew this dummy, pretending they loved this dummy. All the while, their inquisitive minds probed deeper. How does she look? Pretty good, considering. Yeah, Fred always does a great job. Really captures the life.
Fred?
Wurlitz.
Oh,
yeah. I mean, look at the coloring on those cheeks. Like she just came in from the cold. So rosy. So lifelike. This is a nice casket, too. Looks comfortable.
Yeah, is that velvet?
That can't be velvet.
No,
it's not velvet. Goodness sakes, they don't line caskets with velvet. And all the while, they would toss about the word, life, as if it had any bearing on the husk around which they huddled. No, Ellen knew what it really was.
It was nothing. It was emptiness. It was death. A celebration of death. How grand a metaphor could there be? There was a steady, if not slow, stream of people, perhaps 3 an hour. Mostly they were friends of George, friends who had watched the girls grow up and stepped back out of their lives once they reached adulthood. That is the way, isn't it? To nurture and to feed until one is capable of nurturing and caring for oneself. It is taken for granted that this is the case. It is not thought of that this is the way of things. Ellen excused herself, lightly touching her father's shoulder, and stepped outside. George continued speaking softly and slowly to another of the faceless bereaved. She knew her father would be okay, that he would, in fact, glean some small amount of comfort from the company of others. Ellen couldn't look at them. She stood across the parking lot, her back against George's car. There was the usual group of smokers huddled just outside the door. Ellen wanted desperately to avoid them, to avoid their faces and their words, to avoid their own avoidance. Out here, away from the dummy, the guest of honor, their conversation would remain outside of the event. They would speak of cars and work. They would speak of the game and the inevitable outcome. They would speak of weddings and graduations and other futile acts of preservation. Ellen wanted only silence. How else can one honor the dead than by mimicking their silence, their stillness? She saw Skirbish arrive. His hair was neatly combed. He was wearing a suit. Ellen hadn't imagined him in a suit, and his uniform had looked awkward on him. This was the case now. The unfamiliar rags hung from his body as a testament to his meager salary and, if nothing else, to his determination. Skirbish made his way through the smokers, the bleacher seats of the spectator sport, shaking a few hands as he went. Once inside, Ellen knew he would seek out her father. Ron Skirbish would, as all the others, stand patiently in line, filing slowly past the open casket, the museum display, and eventually offer a weak hug to George. George was strong, and Ellen had watched him weather the first half of the day and come out ready to deal with that with which he must deal. His eyes still remained ringed red, bloodshot and weary, but the tears were gone. He composed himself because all would look to him for composure. Skirbish would offer condolences, and then he would lean closer and quietly ask about Ellen. She knew this. She hoped he would not find her, but suspected he would. Out here, hiding in the open. It wasn't that she didn't want to see him. Actually, she kind of did want to see him. He had an easy way about him, and his discomfort mirrored her own. But not here. God, not here. No more. She finished her cigarette and lit another immediately with a trembling hand. She thanked herself for buying cigarettes before they arrived. She welcomed the seemingly endless flow of the distraction they provided. What are you doing out here? Shouldn't you be inside?
Smoking, right?
Oh, okay.
What are you doing out here? Shouldn't you be inside? You're missing the show.
Oh, I already went through the line.
Through the line. Down and through the motherfucking line. And all was well.
Part 2. So long. 20. The flowers all begin to wilt. The trees have leaves which all turn brown. Summer now will soon be gone. The days grow short, the nights grow long. It's getting cold. I'll soon be gone. Cassandra Williams. 21. The burial was small, smaller even than the visitation, although the words of Wurlitz likened it more to intimate. Ellen and her father met the minister at a small plot in a corner of the local cemetery. There, under an awning, the careful work of the old man at Gray's monument, whose name Ellen could not remember, sat isolated in the dying grass. It was a damp day, and the stone was dark with moisture. The grass was wet, and the dampness on it gave the brief illusion of growth, of life. Ellen knew better. She knew that within a month the ground covering would be flat and brown, obscured even further by a thin layer of snow. The ground would wait patiently for the next spring, and would come back thicker, fuller, richer. It would come back and hide that which lay beneath it. The minister spoke words Ellen didn't hear. Her attention was focused on the hole dug in the damp earth. It was dark, a gaping mouth, but it had been prepared the same way Cassie had. It was given the look of comfort, of something just. Bright green artificial grass covered the pile of dirt and the edges of the hole, and a smooth steel riser covered the opening. On top of this riser was the casket, and Ellen saw it now as even more trivial than before. Here, in the wet grass under the gray sky, the finality of it was unavoidable. In a few moments, the casket would be ceremoniously lowered and covered in dirt from the nearby pile, then with sod. The velvet would absorb moisture and begin to slowly decay itself. The polished exterior of the frightful box would begin to buckle, and eventually, it may well collapse, leaving nothing but a large, rectangular divot in the cyclical green lawn. What a fucking tribute it is, all right. George was a portrait of composure. He stood beside her, head bowed and silent. His hands were neatly folded in front of him, as if preparing to receive some sort of acknowledgement, as if waiting patiently in line for the men's room or a phone booth. Occasionally, he would glance sidelong at Ellen, wondering what she was thinking. He would find her, of course, appearing utterly unaffected. Her veil of faux condolence dropped. He appreciated her honesty. George Williams knew that Ellen would deal in her own way, and it didn't take much deduction to decipher her reaction to the events before her. He knew that she placed little or no importance on ceremony, but he also knew that she understood the need for it, the need to somehow embrace the tradition as the first step of the age-old protocol of the grieving process. It was here, standing amidst the dead, in the near silence of a chilly afternoon, that Ellen, for the first real time that day, pondered the question which had been nagging her since her arrival. The father. She thought back to the visitation, sorting through possible suspects in the convenient lineup provided. She could think of none, not to say he wasn't there. Here, for the first time, the sadness of it superseded the oddness. Why had no one come to her, or to her father, to offer the relief of knowledge? Why wasn't this addressed by anyone but herself with any kind of concern? It seemed to her as if the shame bestowed to the fact took precedence over the respect owed. Her head seemed to spin for a moment. She turned to her father and spoke softly, below a whisper. Her voice faltered and betrayed her. Dad? George turned to her, meaning to respond. He did not, however, grasp the meaning of the question. She was not addressing him. George watched her close her eyes and reached out for her. Tried to close his hand around her arm to steady her, but found he wasn't fast enough. Under the gray blanket of sky, and beside the freshly dug grave intended for her little sister, Ellen Williams fell.
22.
An assortment of vivid colors and subtle movement greeted Ellen as she swam slowly back into consciousness. All was a blur, a broken kaleidoscope before her. She heard voices. She thought there were voices, at least, but could not decipher their words or meaning. All was enmeshed into a cocoon around her head. She felt probing hands touching her, prodding her. She thought she heard her name. Then all at once the world was slammed into sharpness, the colors retreated, the voices clarified themselves. All was stripped away, and she was left in the same monochromatic landscape she had left. The graveyard. She blinked and tried to move. A sharp pain attacked her neck. She cursed and triggered another pain, this one on her forehead. Her vision slipped again, just for a second, before focusing on the three figures above her. Ron? She softly asked, more out of disbelief than curiosity. Ron Skirbish smiled down at her, and then looked across to George. Ellen, you fell. Just sit still for a minute. Her father's words didn't register, and she tried to move again. The pain returned. You're bleeding, Ellen. It was Skirbish again, his young face filled with genuine concern. She tried to speak again. Where am I? What's going on? How am I bleeding? What are you doing here, Ron, for Christ's sake? Skirbish and George looked to the minister between them. He shrugged and stepped back, out of Ellen's view. With possession ruled out, it was not his area of expertise, she imagined. Her thoughts were lucid, but her ability to articulate them was somewhat hampered by a growing headache and a bit of nausea. She looked around, shifting her eyes from side to side and careful not to move her head. All was as it should be. The casket on the riser, the fake grass, a small awning put up to protect them from the feeble rain. She saw that the minister had retreated to where two men in suits, one of them she recognized as George Worlitz himself, stood behind the casket. They were readying its descent. She was lying directly beside the casket, perhaps only 2 feet from the hole itself. How marvelously ironic would it have been had she plunged headlong and drooling into the hole intended for Cassie. Then she was being pushed, no, pulled, upward. She found her feet and stood, head down, as if in prayer. On either side, the two men held her firmly, steadily. She took a moment and breathed deeply. I think I'm okay. I think I'm okay. I can stand. I can stand. She repeated each sentence, once for them and once for herself. Are you sure? Skirbish asked. His voice was low and soft, his face close to her ear. She felt warmth from his breath, and in that moment she loved it. She needed it. I'm sure. I'm sure. She felt their grips loosen, but not release. She welcomed it and took a moment to test her balance. It was fine. She was fine. She felt suddenly very nervous. A need to finish the ritual before then washed over her. This day was not, after all, about Ellen Williams. Shall we proceed, gentlemen? It was the minister, standing anxiously with his book open. Must have a wedding this afternoon, Ellen mused to herself. George nodded, glancing once again at Ellen to make sure she was steady. The minister proceeded and balanced between two men, each wondering in their own way who she was. Ellen Williams watched her little sister lowered into the ground, encased in a shiny new box, forever entombed beneath the small, simple carved stone and the small, simple white lie. Cassandra Williams, daughter, sister, friend. 1975-2003. 23. The three of them stood awkwardly beside their vehicles. Behind them, amidst the rows of the dead, two faceless men set to work entombing Cassie Williams. The minister had left already, politely excusing himself with a handshake and a solemn nod after the brief graveside service. Any plans he had were made all the more pressing by Ellen's spell. George was the first to break the silence. I told Ed Sullis I'd stop by this afternoon after... His eyes drifted to the working men. Skirbish filled the gap. I can take Ellen home. He turned to address her. How are you feeling? I'm fine, I think. I can go with you, Dad. It's no problem. No, no. You go home, get some rest. I'll be back tonight. Ed does love to talk. He smiled weakly. Ellen didn't bother with a return. He leaned over and kissed her cheek, lingering a moment, trying to assess her state through sheer proximity. I'll make sure she gets home okay, Mr. Williams. Skirbish took Ellen's arm as a sign of protectiveness. George nodded and turned to his car. What the fuck is going on? Ellen asked, not really expecting an answer. You fainted. No, I mean, what the fuck is going on? Why am I here? Jesus! She waved as George pulled away, then sat down on the curb. Skirbish sat beside her. I don't... For Christ's sake! I feel like I'm fucking swimming, Ron. I can't... Jesus, I'm still here. Skirbish looked down into the road, clasping his hands together, then stated, Well, the grieving process is tough. Ellen looked over at him, her mouth half open. Fuck you, and what the fuck do you know about tough, and what the fuck do I know about tough, and Jesus Christ, why am I still here, and why am I on this curb in this goddamn shitting cemetery? Why? Really? She shut her mouth and smiled. Yes, it is, Ron. You gonna take me straight home, or are you going to try and take my mind off all this shit? I guess I'm going to try to take your mind off of all this shit. 24. So how did you happen to be lurking in the shadows out there this afternoon? They were in a bar, one of two in town, one of four in the valley. They both nursed beer from a pitcher. Behind them, a handful of locals, regulars, chatted softly and watched a college football game on an old television suspended in the corner. Occasionally, one of them would let loose a sharp, guttural laugh. Mostly they spoke quietly and pretended to watch television. Skirbish adjusted his chair. You don't need to be embarrassed or anything, or, Jesus, I don't know. Whatever made you do that. You don't need to. I went there for you. She looked at him with a face impossible to read. It scared him a little. He continued. Not like that. I just wanted to make sure you were all right. Good thing, and she lightened a bit. He exhaled too sharply, and she grinned at him. It struck her then that perhaps she drank too much, or too quickly. It was unlike her. Despite the turbulent emotional ups and downs of her life, Ellen valued self-control over everything. Oneself was the only constant one had, after all, and to devaluate that seemed to her a cardinal sin. Yet here she was, in a crummy, chummy bar, filled with mildly depressed regular patrons drinking to, in fact, lose what little self-control they had left, and she, at least for the moment, seemed no different. Skirbish, however, was in complete control of his own emotions, and this scared him sometimes more than anything else. He longed at times for the release of intoxication, but would not allow himself to succumb. He had trained himself to be aware at all times, even in sleep, of the raw truth of his surroundings. He needed to. He needed the constant reassurance that he was in control of his own fate, and therefore his emotional state was under the same dictatorship. Usually. Sitting here with Ellen Williams, being close enough to make out the small imperfections of her skin, close enough to smell the scent beneath her perfume, he felt precariously close to losing that control he relished so deeply. He would do anything for her in this moment. All she had to do was ask. He wanted to tell her this. Thought it would perhaps provide some small comfort to her. What are you thinking, Ron? I'm thinking about how great it is to see you. Really. Liar. No, I am. I'm glad you're here, Ellen. I wish it were under better circumstances. Well, we can't always get what we want, can we? I guess not. You're much quieter than you were the other night. Nerves, I guess. Then or now? She casually emptied the pitcher into her glass, flicking her eyes up at him in a way that made his skin feel electric. Both. I didn't think you'd want to take me out again, Ron. His body tensed a bit, conditioned to react to that terse, airborne tension, perhaps. I thought perhaps I was a bit too much for you. Not at all, Ellen. I guess I don't know how to act around you. After this exchange, Skirbish half expected the conversation to shift, to begin a long descent to... We should dance, he blurted, unsure why, even as the words escaped. He tensed further, his muscles straining against themselves. Across from him, Ellen simply looked. She smiled a little, and he knew in that instant what a fool he must be. Surely she could see this. Yeah, she said simply. She stood up and grabbed his arm, and they proceeded to the center of the room. There was no dance floor. Places like this didn't have dance floors. But Ellen pushed aside one of the small round tables and made room. The patrons at the bar didn't even look up at them. Skirbish crossed to the jukebox, knowing already that it was filled mostly with old country tunes and Bob Seger. He fished a quarter from his pocket and cracked his neck, anxious as hell at what he may find upon his inspection. And then Ellen saved him. Something slow, Ron. Okay. And he faced the music and smiled, only half believing it was happening at all. He had a feeling after their last night together that he could have pursued her, could have spent the night with her, but it didn't feel right to him. Not then. Not to do that. But now, oh, now all he wanted was to press himself against her and close his eyes, breathing in the aura that surrounded her. The thought made him smile, appearing in his mind as a full sentence as it did. Aura? Jesus. He had a crush, that's it. Somehow, keeping the perspective made it all that much more exciting for him. His coin found its purpose, and the gaudy box in the corner of the bar began pumping a tacky, slow song into the room. The patrons at the bar turned slowly to inspect. Ron Skirbish walked back to her, and she pulled him close. He was afraid she'd feel him tremble a bit. The excitement was killing him. Instead, she latched on, and they began to gently sway. I've always hated dancing, she whispered to him. The words were so soft. Jesus. Me too, he responded, and his own words felt right in that moment. they felt like the perfect thing to say. This was happening, and despite what may happen the next day, or next week, or next year, right now, dancing with Ellen Williams in a bar in their hometown, he was the fucking man. He tried to keep himself from beaming. This is goofy, Ron, but nice. Definitely goofy, though. Yeah, I can't dance to save my soul, Ellen. You're not doing that badly, she said, and her hand moved slowly and gently on his back, and he thought for a moment that he would be the next to faint, and he would come to with Ellen and two of his bar's lifers hovering over him. Their words would be unable to penetrate him, and eventually they would give up. They would leave him there on the floor. He would lie looking up at the unmoving ceiling fans and neon beer signs. He would smell the stale smell of a bar floor, all old alcohol and traces of those who came before. He would close his eyes then, and then let the darkness wash over him, and he would feel no guilt, and he would be ready, because he stood there with this woman, and she moved her hand on him, and if anything else in the world was worth coma and death, he couldn't name it. He didn't fall. Yeah, neither are you. 25. As they walked to his car, Ellen knew that she would have to ask. She could tell he wanted it, probably more than she did, but he would not take the forward step she needed him to take. She would ask, it would be her move, and this would alleviate much of the pressure for him. The result would be the same, and it would be of her own volition. "Take me home," she said. "Okay. Your home." She saw him smile again and knew then it would happen. She needed it. Perhaps it was the beer or the sad course of events that had led her here. But she didn't care at all about reasons. She wanted the release. She needed this night the wanton exchange of trust, the connection. Okay. They walked then, unchanged. There was a knowing between them that romance was not an option, that carnal lust must prevail, but they accepted this and they welcomed it. We should stop at a drugstore. They laughed together. 26. The next morning, after the playful excitement of the sex had subsided, a dull throbbing at the back of her skull taking its place, Ellen walked back to her father's house as the first muted hues of blue and violet entered the sky. She had left Skirbish a note, curt but amiable, explaining her departure. It pained her to write it. It pained her to have to write it. Ellen had had her share of lovers, but the reality of a one-night stand with a high school acquaintance and the Rockwell painting of her hometown was a leap even for her. Regret would be too strong a word, as she did enjoy the evening and the time the two of them spent that night was genuinely fun, but she wished it hadn't happened nonetheless. Guilt seemed more appropriate. She imagined it was the circumstance more than anything, more than even the drink, which had led to it. She had been attracted to him since their first evening walk when she arrived in town, but it was a friendly attraction, and she knew she was no more compatible with him than any of the other lonely men spending their years in the valley. She hoped she would not see him again, not right away, and that, too, caused a pang of guilt in her. It was a chilly morning, but the walk wasn't very long, and she needed the fresh air to clear her head. George would be up by now. Ellen knew he would assume she was in bed when he arrived home, and therefore she wouldn't be missed. She knew further the last thing he would expect was that she had slept with Ron Skirbish the night of her sister's burial. It was the last thing she would have expected of herself, but the day had proved more than strange. Ellen, too, had been interned. She should have been in bed, perhaps. The first few passing cars gave her an approximation of the time, and her mind turned to what had happened the day before. She had fallen, perhaps in more ways than one. She had never experienced fainting or blackouts before. The event perplexed her as much in hindsight as it had when it occurred. Surely it was a reasonable assumption that the stress of recent events, Cassie's death, the return to this town, the awkward dance she and her father continued to use, could lead to a breakdown. But she hadn't had a breakdown. She had simply fainted, with little precursor and no sustained after-effects, none that she could see. In fact, she thought, an air of nonchalance had guided every step she had taken here so far, despite the significance of it all. It was like she had been dreaming the trip in its entirety. Moments of clarity punched through the fog, the funeral home, her sister's apartment, but even these seemed so strange to her that for a second she wondered if any of it had really happened. Then she stepped onto the walk that led to her father's front door, and any doubt sealed itself deep within. A strange few days, yes, but a necessary reality, nonetheless. She stopped at the front door and looked in. George sat at the dining room table, a newspaper spread before him. He was not reading it, however. She looked more closely and saw that he was looking just past it, a lost look in his eyes as he raised a cup of fresh coffee to his lips. They needed to do what needed to be done, but she could rush into it no more than he could. They both trusted that the right steps would make themselves clear when the time was right, and all they could do now was find comfort in one another, and comfort with one another. She opened the door and stepped inside. George looked up, a bit confused, as she stripped her coat off and walked to where he sat. He looked at her dress, the same one she had worn the day before. He looked up to where she stood. "Long night?" "Yep. You?" "Yes. There's coffee." She turned to grab a mug from the dish rack on the counter. That was it. George decided he would pursue it no further. What was the use? Ellen sat down across from him. "You haven't made it very far." "Huh?" "The paper," she said, pointing. "You're on the second page." "Having trouble concentrating, I guess." "How are you?"
"I'm fine."
"No, how are you really? Holding up?" "It's hard, Ellen. After yesterday, I think I should be asking you. How are you?"
"I'm not sure.
I don't know. I'm confused." He frowned. His forehead separated into deep creases. She recognized this. It was familiar.
"Confused about what?"
"I don't know." George nodded. Ellen sipped her coffee carefully, paying careful attention to the slight shake in her hands. She looked at the calendar taped to the refrigerator. A puppy playfully poked its head and paws out of a pumpkin, a curious look on its face. Behind it, dead leaves formed a single, flat layer across the ground. Her eyes dropped to scan the days. She had a week and a half left. A week and a half before the day she had set herself for her departure. She wondered briefly if she'd make it that long. 27. After Ellen had gone upstairs to shower, George slipped back into the daze he was in before she arrived. His thoughts meandered slowly around her arrival home that morning, and it didn't take much deduction to arrive at the truth of the events the night before. It surprised him a bit. He didn't take quiet yet authoritative Ron Skirbish for the womanizing type, but he figured it was a welcome release for Ellen and pushed the lurid details out of his head. He sipped his coffee slowly, wishing he had another of Ellen's cigarettes and her embossed lighter. His eyes slowly scanned the kitchen, but found nothing. He hoped Ellen had left a pack. She hadn't. He turned to the paper again. It sat open to the second page. Ellen had noticed, but it slipped her mind just like it had slipped his. Somewhere further in, buried between the wedding announcements and the ads for used cars and RVs, was the final testament to his younger daughter, a disgusting thing of black and white, of words and promises broken. He sipped his coffee again, knowing he would eventually have to turn to it, to read it, and even to clip it out. These things were done, but with Ellen here, he had slowly begun to realize the futility of such rituals. George saw the way she had reacted to the rounds they had taken days earlier. He saw how to Ellen it was a morbid charade. Perhaps she was rubbing off on him, but perhaps seeing her reaction spurred something in him, some knowing previously unacknowledged. George licked his finger and began to slowly turn the pages, scanning the headlines on each one without any real interest. It was a diversion. He passed the comments, the scant world section with its declarations of peace and war, and eventually settled on the local news page, knowing it contained with it the object of his current derision. He turned the first page, and there it was, beneath a photograph of two smiling newlyweds. They looked barely old enough to drive, but the caption proclaimed them Mr. and Mrs. John Forsythe, ages 19 and 20, respectively. They smiled out at him, arms linked, formal wear immaculate, in mockery of what lay below them. George let his vision descend slowly, past the shine shoes of the new Forsythes and the floral arrangements at their feet. His eyes fell heavily onto the bold print. Cassandra Williams. He shut the paper quickly, an instinctual reaction. He was recoiling from a flame which had licked at his flesh but not found a home. He pushed the paper away forcefully, watching as it slid off the table and onto the floor. God damn these times. He spoke quietly to himself and to everyone. He rose quickly, not bothering to push in his chair, dropped his coffee in the sink, and walked into the living room. They stood there a moment, taking in the emptiness of the house, despite the sound of water forced through the pipes and out of the showerhead upstairs. He walked 3 long steps to the armchair and dropped into it with a heavy sigh. He had mourned the loss of a daughter before, but with the passing of Cassie there was no hope for a reunion, no hope for a second chance with her. Furthermore, he found himself conflicted by the excitement of Ellen's return. He knew he should be grieving, not rejoicing. There was a process, after all, and strict adherence was necessary to move on, wasn't it? Besides, Cassie had stayed. She had not left him angrily, she had not shut him out of her life. She had stayed, and while there had surely been distance, it was a manageable one. Then why had she done what she did? Why hadn't she come to him? Why hadn't she told him who the father was? George leaned forward slowly and placed his face gently into his open hands. He felt it rising from somewhere deep within him and let it come. He wept. Somewhere above him, the shower stopped. He opened his fingers and peered out into the room. There, in the center of the room, he could see himself, decades younger, standing with his daughters. He could see himself hoisting them onto his shoulders, neighing as he crawled on the now faded carpet. He saw Ellen, still too young to find an interest in boys, let alone recreational narcotics and recklessness, climbing onto the tops of his shoes, her small feet resting weightlessly on his. He saw the first careful steps, checking her balance, and then the two of them were twirling, striding, bouncing, laughing. "Dad?" He turned to see Ellen in the hallway. She was drying her hair with a towel, looking half nervously at him. "Are you okay? What are you doing?" He swallowed hard and looked down at the floor. He couldn't look in her eyes in this moment. He wiped his face, rubbing away the tears with a stained shirt sleeve. Dancing. 28. Round and round and round we go. Cassandra Williams. 29. Ellen knew the scene before she even approached the glass front of the diner. She knew to expect a handful of patrons, mostly regulars, sipping coffee and dabbing at egg yolks with heavily buttered toast. The smell and sound entered her head a moment before she pulled open the door and stepped up inside. The familiar crowd turned, acknowledged her presence, and then returned to their eggs. Ellen watched the door close behind her out of the corner of her eye, and then turned her attention to the woman behind the bar. Monica Dentner, class of 88, waitress and beloved friend of Cassie Williams. Ellen wondered why she hadn't been at the graveside, if she was such a good friend, that is. She stepped forward and spoke. "Monica." Monica turned to her with a blank look, a lack of recognition, then, "Ellen! I was hoping you'd come back!" Ellen smiled and sat down at a stool. Monica rushed over, dropping a menu in front of her. "Just stopping for a bite, or are we going to grab that drink?" Monica smiled, and for a second Ellen pitied her. She saw in Monica's eyes genuine excitement, though the two had never been close. What her life must be like to view this intrusion as a blessing. Desperation was the only answer Ellen could fathom. "Actually, Monica, I think I'd like to take you up on that. If you're buying, that is." She let the words slide casually out of her mouth, despite the effort it had taken to summon them. She was good at this game, at playing into people's expectations. "Great, great. Of course. Least I can do for an old friend." Inside, Ellen grimaced. Monica Dentner glanced at a clock on the wall, then continued. "I get off in an hour. Do you want to hang around here until then?" "Probably not. Things to do." She frowned. "Why don't we meet somewhere in an hour?" Ellen's voice was cool and level, and she hoped she didn't sound too indifferent to Miss Dentner. There was calculation seeping into it, void of the friendly, chit-chatty quality in Monica's. "That would be great, yeah. I can't wait. You remember the bar, I'm sure. If not, I suppose you can find it. Ellen smiled and nodded, finished the game, for now at least. Outside the diner, a chilly wind had sprung up, and Ellen wrapped her coat tightly around herself, holding it shut with her hands. She looked up, another clear sky, pristine and glacial. She surveyed her surroundings, hoping to find something new, something overlooked. The landscape offered nothing, just the same collection of old buildings and dirty cars that had greeted her a week earlier, that perhaps had been awaiting her arrival far longer than that. Her eyes lit on the bridge across the street and contemplated it. It had been over a decade since she had last hung her head over and looked down into what surely was a great chasm then. Ellen took a few plaintive steps toward it, letting drop the shroud of geniality she had carried into the diner. She crossed the street slowly and stopped just short of the metal guardrail. She could see beyond it. Dead trees lined up against the flat sky, testaments to the passing of time, while below, icy water continued its trickle unabated. In another month's time, the water would flow even more slowly, this time beneath a sheet of ice thick enough to support a man's weight. The water never halted, never froze completely, merely slowed in times of freezing. It endured like so little else could, pushing on through life's cycle. The water, she thought, would never stop. It would continue to flow along the sleek rocks and moss-covered banks, through town after town, until it reached its destination. Yet in time, it would be pulled up from the earth only to be spat back down to continue the whole sordid thing. It was endless, ceaseless. She wondered if it was tiring for a moment, then took the few steps necessary to reach the guardrail. She closed her eyes as she leaned her weight on it, pushing her face up to the wind and sky and breathing deeply of the crisp air, though it hurt the soft tissue of her nostrils to do so. Below her, she could hear the water gurgling, a constant soft murmur. She bowed her head and opened her eyes, looking down. The drop was not nearly as far as she remembered, no more than 10 feet. It looked miniature, like a mock-up of her memory. Her eyes traced the rocks and banks, scouring the underbrush for some sign that this truly was a hoax, that surely the great raging waters she remembered were hidden somewhere below. They found a rusted bicycle, a condom wrapper, a broken glass bottle. She looked around, then hoisted herself over the rail, and inching along, began to descend. Her feet dropped to the frozen ground with a soft thud, her knees taking the shock. She looked up at the underside of the bridge, examining the abandoned mud nests left by bird and insect alike. She looked down then, crouching to peer into the clear water. She saw a crayfish scuttle between two stones and pondered whether such a creature would hibernate. If not, surely it had no business scooting about in waters near freezing. Here, on the edge, the current slowed, forming a small pool of gently circling water. It rippled softly, small undulations white with the sky's reflection. She cocked her head slightly and saw her own reflection appear on the water's surface. She smiled, and the water mimicked, lapping quietly at her feet while warping the reflected gesture. Ellen turned to watch the water flow beneath the bridge, wondering how long it took for each molecule to drift its way to the mill pond she knew was its resting place before beginning the cycle anew. The cycle, the eternal pushing and pulling. The river would move forever. Until it was dammed, that is. 30. Monica Dentner was waiting when Ellen arrived. She sat alone at a table in the corner with an air of familiarity that unsettled Ellen a bit. The local tavern was one of two staples in town, the other being the diner, which always housed a troop of regulars. Monica Dentner, it seemed, was recognized at both. "Have you been waiting long?" Ellen asked as she slid her jacket over the back of the wooden chair opposite Monica. "No, not at all. Just got here, actually. I ran home to change quick." Ellen gave Monica's attire a cursory glance, noting little difference. Her dress was plain and light, printed with a floral pattern which bent slightly around Monica's ample bosom. Ellen realized that Monica had dressed up for the occasion, wanting to make an impression. Monica, for her part, was equally critical of Ellen's appearance in that brief moment in which her eyes flitted up, down, and level again. It had the air of an interrogation, brief as it may have been. Ellen dropped into her chair with a light sigh, and regretted it. She would have to be careful of displaying too much of anything. She would have to play her cards carefully in avoidance of them being read. Of course, there was nothing at stake, not really. But she sensed a need to retain the air of collected mystery the town had reserved for her in her absence. Monica smiled.
So, have you been enjoying your visit back?
Yes, Ellen said without thinking. Her response was reactionary. She silently scolded herself, then looked at Monica. The question. She viewed Monica as something of an enigma, not in the sense that her very being was brought into question, but Ellen could not register what in this woman made her so... so fucking clueless, she thought. Perhaps it was isolation, a life spent with little contact with the world outside the valley. It wasn't a matter of tact, and Ellen was not offended, but she couldn't help but question the woman's intentions. A waitress appeared out of the haze of smoke drifting through the room from the bar and glared down at the two of them. Ellen looked beyond her to the bar and saw that the girl was in fact the only employee, at least tonight. She made a note not to hold any grumpiness against the girl and smiled up at her. "What can I get you?" Monica spoke first, an automated response that sent a slight chill through Ellen's body. "Heineken." Out of the corner of her eye, Ellen saw Monica fidgeting with the edge of her dress, perhaps trying to dispel nervous energy. It struck her again that for many people this one-room dive was home away from home. "I'll have the same." The waitress, bartender, turned and left to fetch their beverages. Ellen turned to Monica, who offered a cheery smile. Ellen saw through it. "Why are you here, Monica?" "What do you mean?" Her smile dampened a bit, just a little. "Why are you still here, in town?" Monica shrugged, avoiding the thought, and answered, "I don't know. Never had a reason to leave, I guess. I had a job, had an apartment and a car. Why mess with a good thing?" She laughed nervously. Ellen contemplated what her reaction should be for a split second before the waitress, bartender, rescued her, dropping two green bottles onto the table in front of them. Ellen smiled up at her again, but it was too late. She caught the back of the waitress's head as the bearded man at the bar waved for another drink, and then they blurred. The room seemed to stretch, to push the bar away and cause the division between the two sects to grow and grow and grow, a chasm opening forth large enough to swallow the lot of them. The voices of the patrons dropped to a low, echoing murmur, and Ellen felt at once both alone and terrified. She felt the wall behind her digging into her back and watched her feet slide toward the edge of the great divide. She was trapped. It was trapping her. She swallowed down panic, feeling it burn her stomach, and breathed deeply, knowing the only course of action was presenting itself as a viable alternative to falling into the void beside her. She turned to Monica and said, a breathy expulsion of words, damned words, and the meaning they carried, "Tell me about my sister." Part 3. Godspeed. 31. As Ellen walked back to her car, her mind swam with a thousand scenarios, all of them miles from the truth. That truth, that simple, unquestionable fact, was that no one had known Cassandra Williams. No one. Not even the people who claimed to be her friends, the people who toted her name like a badge of honor after her death. Ellen had desperately wanted her sister's death to be different, to be a break from the pathetic charade which accompanied all small-town affairs. It wasn't. Like any great tragedy, or any small, people had come out of the woodwork not to gain support or to provide it, but simply to jump onto the bandwagon. Death, not unlike life, was swallowed by the pop culture mentality which governed most people's lives. Ellen cursed under her breath, a desperate act to retain control. It was also a silent indictment of human nature, she supposed. Not that either would do any good. Her hand fumbled with the keys as she did little more than scratch the paint around her door lock. She was growing accustomed to being uneasy, to losing control over the most rudimentary functions. That thought scared her more than anything, perhaps. The thought that, like death, grief was permanent, even if clouded and disguised by an otherwise cold and deliberate temperament. She spun around, pressing her back hard into her car for support and balance. She squeezed her eyes tightly shut. Monica had told her little, but the implications of what she said were strong enough to nearly paralyze Ellen Williams, a confirmation of the fear burning her head for the past week. Monica Dentner had offered one solid piece of new information, however. In fact, it was the answer to the question on everyone's lips. though Ellen now imagined for more than a few of them the question itself was an act. Monica had divulged what Ellen hadn't thought she would ever find out. She had spoken a name, a single name, which had changed everything. She knew who the father was, who Cassandra had been seeing. She knew, and she told Ellen. Ellen let her knees let go and slowly slid to the ground. She pushed her feet out, straightening her legs, and dropped her head. It wasn't until she saw a drop hit her hand that she realized she was crying. She tilted her head back, letting it rest against the cool steel of her Nova. Somewhere off to her right, she heard a rustling in the bushes. Her head lazily turned to meet the sound head-on, an instinctual reaction. After a moment, a raccoon popped out, its nose to the ground. It stopped then and looked at her. In its small eyes, Ellen saw something with which she could relate. An icy chill shot up her spine as she locked eyes with the beast. There was a cunning in them, an urgency, too, and she felt it reflected in her own. After a second, the raccoon shook its head and moved on out of sight, probably to forage through the tavern's trash for scraps of food and old beer bottles. Ellen closed her eyes again, the chill not completely gone. It remained like everything else seemed to. She whispered the man's name, Thomas Mullen, Jr. In that moment, her head leaning against her resting car, a clear sky overhead shepherding stars across the great expanse, a whimpering raccoon scurrying across pavement to find a meal. In that moment, she was overcome with something so pure and unadulterated, so undeniably real, that she welcomed his presence as she would a cold drink on a blistering day. She welcomed rage. 32. It wasn't more than a quarter of a mile to Town Hall from where Ellen was parked, but it felt like at least five. Dragging an intangible weight behind her, legs burning, lungs aching, the back of her head throbbing, it was a welcome relief to find the trail entrance behind the old building. She stopped in front of it, closed her eyes, and caught her breath. The trail seemed so small now, just a worn spot in the tree line at first glance. The grass and shrubs were worn away, revealing a small dirt patch haloed by burgeoning vegetation. Ellen took a few steps closer and, squinting, made out a few feet of the path before it disappeared into darkness. She looked around her. The town was all but dead. The red brick of Town Hall and the buzzing orange light above the building's back door gave the clearing an eerie ambiance she wished she could ignore. It was peaceful, she supposed, but the forest and what lay beyond lent a sense of foreboding. She felt a knot growing in the pit of her stomach. "Fuck it," she said to no one, and pushed through the branches into the forest. Behind her, the orange light continued to buzz. A stiff wind caught the trees for just a second, and then all was calm once again. Her eyes took a minute to adjust, but once inside the trees, she was able to make out more of the trail than she thought she would. She followed it up with her eyes, through the trees, to the base of the hill, and then upward into a place that until now had existed only in her memory. She stood in the dark and pulled her cigarettes from her pocket, quickly lighting one despite shaking hands and a growing shiver. It was cold tonight, and only getting colder. 15 minutes and 2 half-smoked cigarettes later, Ellen emerged from the undergrowth into the clearing at the top of the hill. It was a steep climb, and life in the concrete jungle had done little for her physical stamina. She fell to her knees and closed her eyes, breathing heavily. She felt her head start to reel, perhaps from lack of oxygen, perhaps from something else. She stood after a moment and looked out over the tops of the trees. "So small," she whispered. After she said it, she wondered to what exactly her comment had referred. Looking down on the town, her eyes found a collection of worn rooftops, dimly lit streets snaking and intertwining. She saw the Route 26 bridge, imagined the faint gurgle of gently coursing water. She saw the town hall and for a minute couldn't believe it was so far away. She saw the bar and imagined Monica Dentner inside, working on her 4th Heineken and wishing it was her 5th. From here, Ellen saw everything. Slowly, she turned her back on the town and faced the clearing. She hadn't known what to expect when she got here, but it certainly wasn't this. The clearing was empty, silent, rather disenchanting. It held none of the mystique she had placed on it from the driver's seat of her car, speeding across the continent. There was no gore, there were no demons, there was no Cassie. She took a couple steps forward and looked down at the dried leaves and dead twigs on the ground. Standard issue for Maine, and very much expected. She stopped, closed her eyes, and tried to imagine where they had found her, where she herself had stopped and looked out over the town before succumbing to toxins coursing through her veins. Where was her last breath? What was her last thought? Did she smile? Ellen opened her eyes and looked around again at the rather unremarkable blotch in the otherwise endless expanse of trees at the top of this hill. What had she expected to find? Perhaps this was it. Perhaps she was looking for a void, an emptiness. Perhaps this was why she had come here, had knocked on her father's door and let him hold her for the first time, and... No. This wasn't why. She frowned, contemplating past and present. She looked down again, kicked a stick at her feet. Thomas Mullen, Jr. She didn't recognize the name. She couldn't picture a face. She couldn't imagine her sister. No, this was indeed empty. This was not it. 33. Sticky sweet and full of meat, the devil's now got two blue feet. And when the sunshine burns away, we shall hear what he shall say. Cassandra Williams. 34. The doorbell woke him, and he had barely sat up in bed before it rang again. By the time he got to the door, still tying his bathrobe shut as he dropped down the stairs, Skirbish was sure there was some great urgency awaiting him. Someone was dead, surely. Perhaps a car wreck. Perhaps a trucker had fallen asleep while passing through town on Route 26 and slammed his rig into one of the old buildings, sending up a plume of smoke and fire and wiping out a handful of lives in the process. Surely the whole fire department would be called. They'd probably have to call in help from neighboring towns as far away as Bethel. He was surprised the explosion hadn't awakened him. Instead, he was greeted by the face of Ellen Williams when he swung the door wide open. The smiling face, even, and the look in her eyes made him a bit uncomfortable in his half-awake state. His eyes narrowed a bit as his brain processed the scenario, but before he had time to calculate a spoken greeting, Ellen was pushing past him into the house. He shut the door slowly and turned to her. "Hi," was all he could come up with. "I didn't wake you, did I?"
No.
It was a lie, of course, but it was the expected lie, and Ellen hadn't expected truth, but rather the welcome invitation contained in that fib. Skirbish scratched his head, his hands ruffling his greasy mussed hair, and Ellen headed into the kitchen. After a second, Skirbish followed, yawning. The shock had subsided, and he trod down the hallway in concession. No point in causing a fuss. "I had a few drinks with Monica Dentner tonight," she said, opening the fridge and digging deep. Her probing hand found a cold glass bottle and grasped, pulling the beer forth. Skirbish watched her tap the cap off with the edge of the counter. She took a deep gulp, then looked up and smiled. Skirbish was a bit unnerved by the casualness with which she gulped so feverishly, not to mention the circumstances behind it. There was something behind Ellen's demeanor, though at present he was at a loss to place it. "What time is it?" Ellen scanned the room for a clock, then gave up and shrugged. 11, I think. Something like that. She drank from the bottle again, greedily downing a third of it before relenting. She felt her desperation, and behind the mask she now wore choked back panic. She continued. "You know Monica?" Skirbish, too tired to indulge his instincts, dropped into a chair and answered, "Yeah, I know Monica Dentner. New friend?" Ellen shook her head. "Old friend, I guess. Or a friend-in-law."
"I see. Did she have anything interesting to say?"
Ellen shook her head again, downing the rest of her beer. Skirbish shrugged, letting it go. He would dig deeper tomorrow. "You spending the night?" he asked, already knowing the answer. As before, his words were unimportant. The speaking of them was the key. Ellen nodded as Skirbish continued, not really waiting for an answer or expecting one. Quickly, "I'm going to bed. You are more than welcome to join me. Or," he watched her head back to the refrigerator, "help yourself to anything you find." He stood and headed down the hall. Ellen, her head hidden behind the refrigerator, closed her eyes.
She listened, waiting for the footsteps to ascend the stairs, to end as he fell back into his bed. She stood slowly, closing the refrigerator and stepping to the center of the room. She looked up at the ceiling as Skirbish's weight hit the mattress. In a minute or two, he'd be asleep. He wouldn't wait for her. She knew that. She was counting on that. 35. I'm not sure what good this does anymore. The catharsis seems to have worn off. The therapeutic relief gained by scribbling my thoughts into this worn volume lessens with every page. Perhaps I need something new. Perhaps I just need something. Life is a grand parade of lies and frivolities, is it not? People happily toiling about in their shells, in their masks, waiting patiently for retirement, waiting for the weekend. And am I any different? I wish I was. I envy those with minds too clouded to perceive the sad truth of this goddamn existence. Listen to me. I sound like Robert Frost on bad acid. I wish I could be truthful. I wish we all could, that we didn't have to wade through this insecurity and all this bullshit like hapless fish swimming upriver. Fuck the current, man. I just want to flop out onto dry land and take in some sun. Work is death, to put it gently. I hate that fucking place. I hate this fucking town. I wish I could leave. I wish I had the resolve. It doesn't take much. Just get in your tired car and go. Just go. Ellen did it. She made it look so easy. But weights are everywhere I look, and before long it's hard enough to go to the kitchen to fix myself lunch. Tom hasn't called in weeks. If the bastard had a phone, maybe I'd call him. If he answered the door when I knocked. What a sad fucking cliche. He told me he cared about me. More self-indulgent whining is just what I need. More ways to cling to the invisible status quo in which every one of us is forced to exist. The days drift slowly forward and I feel like a puppet, a slave to them. There is little relief in sight. I found a penny today, on the street. It excited me. How goddamn pathetic is that? The sight of a forgotten or thrown away penny sitting on the sidewalk brings joy. Shit. I picked it up before realizing it was tails up. Maybe bad luck will befall me now. Maybe the world will turn on me and devour me. Maybe darkness will wash over me like warm milk, or silk, or some other such nonsensical fucking abstraction. God, I hate this. I hate, and I guess that's the saddest part of all. It would be easy to blame it on Tom. Well, actually, maybe I will blame it on him. After all, what's the point of being spiteful if you can't acknowledge it? What a fucking piece of shit asshole! There, I said it. And if I expected flames and fireworks, a Ghostbusters light show to wash over me and purge me of all ill will, well, if I expected that, then perhaps I deserve this. But I suppose it's the price you pay to live in a modern world. Things go fast, baby, and that's all you can do to keep up. From the Journal of Cassandra Williams, dated August 3rd. 36. For the second time that night, Ellen Williams walked up to a darkened house, pulled a mask of ignorant cheeriness over her contempt, and knocked on the door. She stood in the darkness then, awaiting an answer. She turned and looked around at her surroundings, a feeling of déjà vu washing over her and pulsing in the back of her already aching head. How many times would she look around herself in awe and wonderment at the vast nothing that greeted her sight? This place was not unlike any of the others. A little more removed, perhaps. She stood on a makeshift porch, crudely constructed from plywood and plastic pails. The hand-hewn stairs, two of them, led down to a patch of dirt that must have been the front yard. The trailer sat in a small clearing in the forest, about 20 yards from the road, and as she looked up at the full moon, she imagined the place could be quite nice, if someone gave a shit. Off to her side, a dirty Ford Taurus sat silently, probably questioning its existence as much as Ellen was, its usefulness. She frowned at it, suddenly feeling pity for this hapless, inanimate object, imbuing it with all the fears and insecurities she felt in herself. The car returned some sort of confirmation, not in sound or movement, but in a tremble Ellen felt in her feet. And, just as Ellen told herself she was going completely fucking insane, the door opened and she spun to it, losing her composition for a second in the transition. He rubbed his eyes and looked down at her,
half asleep and wondering who the hell would pound on his door, of all doors, in the middle of the night. The fact that it was an attractive woman who was behind the banging fist was seeping in slowly. Ellen took advantage of this and regained herself. She smiled widely, exposing her teeth, glowing white pearls in the blue haze of the clearing's full moon. She had his attention now. His scowl began to fade, and while the confusion remained set in his brow, he softened a bit. "Can I help you, miss?" He had called her miss. "Did I wake you up?" Again, the second time tonight. Patterns were beginning to form, and the knowledge of this crept into Ellen's mind, distracting her. She pushed on. "If I did, I mean, I didn't mean to..." He held up his hand and said with a yawn, "No, it's fine. It's fine. Just wondering what a girl like you is doing pounding on doors at..." He instinctively looked to his wrist, the watch. "It's about 1. She widened her smile, hoping like hell he would go for it, but scared to death that this would work, whatever this was. She was floundering now. But was that really unexpected? Was that unusual? Not anymore, she reasoned. In this tide pool, she was on her knees, pushing her face further and further beneath the surface. She was testing herself, her resolve. How long could she hold her breath, anyway? "Can I come in?" He furrowed his brow, looked up at the sky, and rubbed his chin. The sound was coarse, like sandpaper on a brick, and Ellen stifled a laugh as an image of this man striking a match on his cheek flittered in her peripheral, but for a second. He continued looking up, and she thought perhaps he had forgotten about her, but after a second he looked back down at her. She continued, "If you're busy..." He leaned forward a bit, and when he spoke his words felt sharp, like needles hitting Ellen's face. "Who the hell are you, lady?" Ellen forced a giggle and placed a hand gently on his shoulder before she spoke the words. "Well, you're Tom, right?" 37. Tom opened the refrigerator and pulled out 2 beers. He set one in front of Ellen and she grabbed it, craving the relief it may have contained. Even if it was only a placebo, it was a welcome distraction, the buzz, in that it pulled her ever so slightly from the reality of what was before her. Aside from that, inhibitions were her enemy now, waging a full-on assault on the best-laid plans. And the worst. Tom, now seated in a worn orange recliner across from her, cracked his own beer and spoke. "You've got my attention. I'm awake. Against my will, maybe, but awake. What the hell is going on?" Ellen laughed, sending a drop of beer rolling down her chin. She wiped at it with her palm. Tom squinted at her and took a sip of his own. He continued, "Look, lady, I've been patient with you, and to tell you the truth, I don't know why the hell I let you in here. Christ, middle of the night, goddamn strangers knocking on my door." He stared deep into her. "I was within my rights to shoot you right there." Ellen pushed on, unfazed. "You don't recognize me?" "Should I?" Ellen leaned forward and spoke softly. "I'm Ellen Williams." A momentary lapse of retention, then recognition. "No shit." He smiled and leaned back. "I thought you'd be taller. Cassie said you were taller." At the mention of her sister's name, Ellen felt the crimson ire rise in her, burning her throat like bile. She swallowed it down, replaced its bitter taste with an even more bitter faux smile. She was skirting the edge and could see no end in sight. Here, in the sea, a broken horizon was nothing more than a dream. "Well, Ellen Williams, what can I do for you?" "I'm in town, and..." She just wanted to close her eyes, to lean back and dissolve. "I don't really know anyone else here. Not anymore." "Looking for company at 1 in the morning?" "Something like that." She jumped now. With all the force her body and mind could muster, she leapt in head first, turning her back on any hope of escape. Now, she knew, there was no turning back. She set down her beer and stood. She watched his eyes as they followed her up and over until she was standing over him. She slowly raised her left hand and ran it through his hair, her right going to his face. He said nothing, did nothing. He did not try to stop her. She bent down, brought her mouth close to his ear.
He could not see her close her eyes, could not know that she clenched them shut against the burn of the saline welling in them. A drop escaped, rolled down her cheek, and took with it her last chance at salvation. There was no redemption here. That cold truth was apparent to her now, in this moment, and Ellen knew that to feel nothing, you must be nothing. She whispered the lie. Cassie said you were a good fuck. She felt his body tense as she ran her hand down his chest and further, tracing him with her fingers. She bit her lip, fighting back something more than tears. He exhaled heavily, and she swung her leg over him, setting her weight down onto his lap, onto that which could create and destroy. She felt him growing, felt herself falling deeper and deeper into a web from which she could not escape. She grabbed his head, pulling it down into her chest, and a terse sob escaped her. He did not notice. She had him. She felt his hands go to her thighs, to move up them. She held her eyes closed, terrified of what would greet them should she open them. His hands moved upward skillfully, erasing the buttons of her shirt as if by will alone. He opened it, sent it down and away. He grabbed her hips again, pulled her down against him, and she felt now that he was ready. He was hers if she wanted him. She slid back off of him, gently maneuvering herself onto her knees. She pushed his head back. She could not see him. She did not want to indulge him with the contact of their eyes. In them there might be a knowing. He might see more than her actions. He might see her motivations. His hands grabbed her hair as she opened and exposed. He moaned as she took him into her mouth, and here, on the stained carpet of Tom Moen's trailer, Ellen gave up completely. 38. For the first time in her life, Ellen felt a true disconnect between mind and body, an absolute sense that the physical sensations were detached from her. She felt herself going up, hovering at the low ceiling of the trailer and watching the debacle below. She felt him inside her, but objectively. She felt the pain, but it wasn't real. She knew that. Amputees woke screaming in the night from cramps in a limb removed decades earlier. It was something akin to that which she felt now. The pain made it real, but it was bearable. She saw herself there, bent over a coffee table in the most crude form of coitus, squeezing her eyes shut against humiliation and anguish. She saw Thomas Moen, Jr., kneeling behind her, his robe open and hanging loosely from his shoulders. It seemed the most ludicrous scenario she could picture, but it was right there in front of her, plain as day and painfully real. The subjective view proved that. With the shelter of the deepest recesses of her mind stripped away, pulled away, and up to the fake wood paneling on the ceiling, she could separate the two worlds, but could deny neither. Ellen watched as he reached up and grabbed her hair firmly, pulling it back hard and snapping her back. This had gone too far. Jesus Christ, how had she let it go so far? She opened her eyes and saw not a schematic of the goings-on, but rather a first-hand look at the stained fabric of Moen's couch. He pulled at her hair again, and she gasped. He pushed deeper inside her, and her hand slipped. Her body fell flat onto the table. He let go of her hair and placed both hands on her hips, driving deeper and deeper into her. Fuck, she sighed, not at all in pleasure. He acknowledged her sentiment by picking up speed, and she realized again that she had let it go way the fuck too far. To what end? Where had she lost sight of the plan? The fucking plan. Gods, the motherfucking plan. Without plans, what do we have? Without her plan, she was a whore on a coffee table, fucked sideways and gritting her teeth against the pain. Without her plan, she was lost. Beneath her, on the worn, shitty carpet, an empty beer bottle sat tipped on its side. She looked at it, deep into it, and the resolve returned. Thank God, the resolve returned. Her eyes moved from the bottle to her plain black satchel on the floor beside it. The rucksack she had carried across the continent and into this town and into this trailer, and now it sat weakly on the shitty carpet covering the shitty floor of this fucking motherfucking trailer. She reached for it, her fingertips brushing the strap. She tried to pull it to her, but was pushed hard against the table. The sack shifted and a bright flash of light from inside hit her eyes, momentarily blinding and enchanting her. The light burrowed deep into her head, and it cleansed her.
The light cast an illuminating glow over the fogged haze in her brain. She saw panic there in the gray matter and remembered something she had read once. The brain has no shape in life. It is closer to a viscous liquid than to the rubbery thing of science fiction novels. The brain, the center of physical existence, was malleable. Oh God, yes it was. She reached again and grabbed, squeezing the strap tightly. She pulled as hard as she ever had, and the bag slid across the shitty floor, the shitty carpet, and directly beneath her. In a fluid movement, with hands steadied by a will she hadn't realized still existed, she reached inside. She saw something like surprise and something like anger in his eyes as she rolled over onto her back and kicked him squarely in the chest. He doubled over, slipping out of her, and fell back, landing in his orange chair. He looked at her, completely frozen, and at what she held in her hands. His mouth was agape, his breath caught in the dull throb in his chest where her foot had hit home. Ellen shifted a bit and felt a sharp pain. She looked down and saw she was bleeding. A trickle of blood ran down her thigh, dripped onto the carpet. She looked back up at him, still motionless, still perplexed and terrified, and he started to stand back up, and without thinking, Ellen instinctually squeezed the trigger of Skirbish's chrome service revolver. The report was deafening in the confined space, and Ellen felt it pulse through her head, simultaneously entering through her ears and temples. He fell back again, his mouth open wider now. Ellen shook her head, trying to escape the ringing, but it was futile. She saw his lips move, trying to speak. No, he was speaking. What? She couldn't hear anything but a high-pitched whine that seemed to be coming straight from the back of her head itself, from that slimy gelatin pushing her forward down this god-awful path. She looked down again and saw that her body was misted with blood, thickest on her legs, but present up to her breasts and onto her face. She kept the gun leveled as she looked around the room. She looked down again and saw that her body was misted with blood, thickest on her legs, but present up to her breasts and onto her face. She kept the gun leveled as she looked around the room. The walls were sprayed as well, fine droplets, giving the faded wallpaper a newfound sheen in the dim light from the single dirty lamp on an end table across from her. Ellen looked again to him in the chair. His abdomen was slick with dark red, finger smudges running through it from where he was wiping at it. She spoke to him. He did not respond. She screamed, "Can you fucking walk?" She could barely hear herself, just that pervasive whine and muted mumblings that could have been her own voice. She stood and grabbed a blanket from his couch, wiping herself, trying to erase the blood. It was useless. She looked back to him, his fingers still running across his stomach. Ellen began getting dressed, quickly pulling on her clothes. She kept the gun in one hand and noticed something surprising. She was not shaking. She held a hand out and looked at it, still and steady. She hadn't felt this calm since. She was suddenly terrified. Not of Tom, not of the situation, but of herself. She couldn't stop. She had to keep pushing. She had to use this. There was no turning back. There was no salvation. Not anymore. She turned to him. "Stand up. We're leaving." He did nothing. She leveled the gun at him and spoke calmly and evenly. "Fucking stand the fuck up now, you shit." 39. The ringing in her ears had subsided a bit by the time they got to the car, and as she drove, she felt a bit of relief at that. She glanced in the rearview mirror, saw him leaning against the window, saw his eyes closing. "Don't you fucking die. Stay awake. Stay awake for this, you fucking asshole." She honked the horn, and his eyes opened, drifted to her. "Don't you fucking go anywhere." The steadiness of her voice chilled her. Everything made sense. Everything was following a course. It was predetermined. It was unavoidable. There was no guilt. Not here. She looked into the void through the windshield, saw hints of trees drifting past. She pushed down on the accelerator. The car picked up. She drove on instinct. She felt she could close her eyes. So strong was the sense of kismet. The car would go where it needed to go,
These events would resolve of their own accord. It was fate. It was supposed to be. Ellen slowed the car as she approached the turnoff. She leaned forward, squinting into the gloom, and there it was. She turned the wheel, and the car slid effortlessly off the main road and onto the rutted forest drive. She leaned back and smiled. Thomas Mullen Jr. murmured something in the back seat, and Ellen glanced once again at his reflection in the mirror. His eyes were wide open now, gazing into the black forest outside his window. Surely he recognized. Surely he remembered. The words he spoke were low, almost indiscernible, but Ellen heard them. The hollow. She looked forward again and let the car take her up the hill. Through the thick brush and into the clearing she remembered so vividly. She stopped the car, killed the lights, and pulled the key from the ignition. Without a word, she got out and went around to the car's back door, opening it. Moen spilled out onto the leaf-colored ground with a low grunt. "Stand up, fuck!" He tried to crawl, tried to make it to the brush on the edge of the clearing. Ellen stood above him, pushed him over with her foot. The gun in her hand felt reassuringly heavy. She was fearless. "Stand up." Moen slowly got to his feet and looked at her, leaning his weight on the car. Blood seeped from his open mouth. He tried to speak, but she raised a finger and placed it on his lips. "Don't. We're going to walk now. Not far." She spun him around and pushed as he began to trudge across the clearing, his bare feet scraping along through the dried leaves. Ellen occasionally nudged his back with the gun. She smiled. She felt like Dirty Harry. "That's far enough," she said as they approached the center. She pushed between his shoulder blades with the gun and he fell to the ground. He lay still in the dried grass and then began to moan. Ellen ignored it, instead looking up at the clear sky. God, so many stars here. She had forgotten. A rustling at her feet brought her gaze back down to Moen, who was now clambering away from her at a less than bristling pace. Ellen took two steps and stood over him. "Turn around." He stopped, but did not turn. "Look at me. Fucking look at me." Moen awkwardly turned over, lying flat on his back. He closed his eyes, and Ellen stepped on his hand, putting her full weight on it. She heard the satisfying crack of bone, and Moen began to sob. She stepped again, and he looked at her. Ellen knelt down, descending to him. She straddled him, looking straight into his eyes. "You like that? Does that turn you on?" She leaned forward and relished the sadistic glee in her voice. "Tom!" She pressed the barrel of the gun against his throat, feeling the resistance of his windpipe. He gasped. She grabbed his hair and pulled his face close to hers. And suddenly it occurred to her that there was no need. These actions were semantic now. She let go of his hair and his head dropped. She pressed the gun deeper into his throat and held up her free hand behind it, shielding her face. Without a second thought, without a moment's hesitation, Ellen depressed the trigger. Part 4. The Hollow. 40. She jumped a bit as Monica's hand touched her shoulder. She looked around the dark room, down at the table. The two Heinekens sat half full in front of her. She looked up at Monica, whose expression was something between concern and amusement. Ellen looked over at the bar, where their bitch of a waitress was busy ignoring the patrons. "You know him or something?" Monica's voice was gentle and soothed Ellen a bit. "What?" "Moen. You know him?" Ellen shook her head and looked down at her hands. She pressed them down against the scratched wood of the table to steady them, but it did no good. She could feel the tremble in her shoulders. She grabbed her Heineken and took a big gulp. Still cold. Still cold. How long? "No, I don't know him." Monica relaxed a bit, leaned back in her chair. "Yeah, I don't think he's from around here. Not originally, I mean. He's got an apartment a few blocks away, above the post office." Ellen raised her beer again, emptying the bottle. She looked at Monica, who was fidgeting with the buttons on her shirt, and suddenly felt very much like laughing.
41. George awoke at dawn, as he always did, and spent a good 10 minutes in bed, eyes open, ears attuned. Outside, beneath the ever-lightning sky, the first sounds and signs of movement drifted through the empty streets. He heard a car start somewhere close by and the muted grating of a coffee grinder in one of the neighboring homes. He heard a crackling radio station emanating from someone's open kitchen window, an AM program, morning talk radio. He heard a few hushed voices and the trickling of water in someone's shower. He did not hear any birds. They had finally gotten wise. They had finally fled, and not a moment too soon. While he appreciated the calming sounds of morning, as he lay awake, George regretted leaving the window cracked all night. It was getting cold. Damn cold, and damn quick. George heard these things, but the house felt silent, empty. And it wasn't just the open window. It felt cold. Damn cold. He stared up at the ceiling, the divots and cracks of the plaster familiar to him, yet alien in the blue gloom. A new perspective had taken him in the past days, a new way of thinking and feeling. It was certainly no epiphany, and it wasn't that sort of life-changing occurrence which drove some men to Jesus and others to the bottle. No, this was a subtle change, a slight shifting of the world around him more than George himself. This was... shit, this was just different. He swung his feet over the edge of the bed and sat for a moment, his head hung. Waking up was getting hard these days. Hell, these years. Forcing himself up and out of the relative comfort of the down bedspread, well, that had always been tough. That had been a battle since Catherine's death, and why the hell wouldn't it be? Things had never been easy. These days, everything just got a bit harder. He padded softly out into the hall, pausing outside of Ellen's door. He listened for a moment, heard nothing. Sleeping, probably. Hopefully. Running herself ragged, she was, and that was no good for anyone, especially in times like these. George frowned weakly in the darkness, then scratched his head and moved on. Every morning, same as the last. Every evening, just like the rest. Something like that. Hard to remember things sometimes, too. George's bare feet recoiled a bit from the cold wood at the bottom of the stairs. He took another pause, the first of many in his morning ritual, and continued. Used to be, as a young man, George could roll out of bed and be off on his way to kick the hell from the coming day in 20 minutes. Now it took him 45 to get into the shower. He looked out the front window at the street, immediately noticing that Ellen's Nova was missing. He frowned again and scratched his chin, a subconscious mockery of the old man he'd become. Out late again, he mumbled to no one in particular before turning and shuffling into the kitchen. He flicked on a light, and flickering fluorescent blinded him momentarily. He spat shit, and headed squinting to the coffee maker. He kept his back to the table, and by the time his eyes had adjusted, he had lost count of the scoops of grounds and saw an overflowing mound in the filter. He cursed again and began scooping them back into the oversized can. After turning it on, he slowly swiveled and noticed what lay on the table. He moved to it quickly, stubbing his toe on the first chair he came to. He picked up the single sheet of paper and held it out, squinting to make out the neat print. Had to go. Ellen. He set the paper back down and slumped into a chair. Just like that, she was gone. As quickly as she had reappeared in his life, she had left, had fled. Without so much as a goodbye, a hug or kiss. An oppressive weight settled on his shoulders, and George felt as though his body was being driven into the chair, through the chair and floor and deep into the earth. He felt trapped, but he was paralyzed. He was helpless. His eyes slowly looked up at the receding ceiling, so cracked, so worn. He felt like crying, but couldn't breathe. His chest was tight, and for a second he thought perhaps he was having a heart attack. His back began to creak under the strain, under the intense weight. The goddamn weight. He closed his eyes, squeezed them shut as tightly as he could, and waited for the earth to swallow him. A rush of air and he was back, sitting slouched in a chair at his kitchen table, alone on another dark morning. His eyes were locked on something he hadn't even realized was there. He was staring at something, a phantom,
figment of his ever more senile imagination, he supposed. He blinked, but it did not leave. It did not falter. George stretched out a shaking hand and touched it, this thing, this invader of his home. It was real. He picked it up and brought it to his face, close enough to read the print on one flat side. C.W. It was a book. He flipped it open and knew immediately what it was. A small slip of paper fell out from where it had been carefully placed between the first two pages. It floated to his feet in slow motion, and he watched it, unable and unwilling to stop it. It hit the floor, print up, and for some miraculous reason, George's failing eyes could read the print, could sense it, despite the flickering light and his eyeglasses resting upstairs. Thought you'd like this. E. He sighed and turned to the book. He would like it. He did like it, and he would read it. But not now. No, not now. When he was ready. He felt a warm tear hit his hand and realized he was indeed crying now. He did nothing about it. No reason. In the growing light, amidst the sounds of coffee makers and car doors, George set down the book and headed back upstairs to shower and make Ellen's bed, to wait for her next visit. 42. Ellen drove all night. At dawn, she stopped for gas and shitty coffee somewhere in upstate New York. Oswego, maybe? She couldn't remember, didn't care, before jumping back in her car and pushing onward. She drove all day, chain-smoking and talking to herself. She let her mind wander, but never very far. She reined it back in, rolled down the window, and lit more cigarettes. Always more cigarettes. In Illinois, or was it Iowa? She pulled the car over to the side of the small state highway on which she had been following the interstate's detour. She got out of the car and started to walk away, her hands on her head, her eyes following her feet. What the fuck was she doing? Why had she come? Why was she going back? Good God, the questions. Always the questions. She kicked at a rock and suddenly felt all the strength drain from her, down through her feet and into the ground. Her knees buckled and she collapsed, crumpled onto the side of the road. She felt no pain, just numbness all over. Everywhere anesthetized and numb, feeling less. She looked up for something, anything, but found nothing. Ellen Williams sat alone on the side of the lonely road, a few dead leaves blowing past her feet. The sky above her smoldered itself into a deep crimson, then slowly darkened. The sun slid further and further behind the trees. She looked up and closed her eyes. The sky burned out, and all the world went black.
Afterward. Valediction is many things to me. I suppose the biggest one of them is that it is my first book. I'd call it a novel, for that's surely what it aspires to be, but it was long ago decided that stories of valediction's length were destined to be novellas. Not that it matters, not in the long run. This is my first book, and as such, I have a certain amount of pride in it. Oh, it's no Of Mice and Men, but it's a nice, tight little tale that fits neatly between the covers God gave it. As a filmmaker, I've learned to handle criticism well, and the fact that Valediction is no bestseller doesn't really faze me. There are at least a handful of people out there, you included, I hope, that have enjoyed it and, God willing, walked away with a little something extra tucked deep into the back pocket of their heart. I'd like to thank you now for giving me the opportunity to tell you a story and impose on you a few of my own observations of our world. I'm working on the next work now, as well as pushing hard to get the next film off the ground, and I leave you with this. If anyone is still listening to me prattle on after Valediction, then perhaps there's hope for all of us. Jacob Strunk, Hollywood, California, December 7th, 2004.
The velvet would absorb moisture. The velvet would absorb moisture and begin to slope.
Like a duck.
The velvet would absorb...
absorb... I just keep saying that.
The velvet... The velvet would absorb moisture and begin to
slowly motherfucking decay.